Welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 337. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are John Lindemann.
A pleasure to be here, Johnny.
Guillaume Viette.
Hey.
And James Jones.
Hi.
There has been so much interesting stuff going on lately. We have been getting some of the best emails we've ever gotten the past few weeks, and we are going to devote the majority of this episode to listener mail, covering a very wide range of topics and a lot of video games and some industry stuff and some controversial E3 craziness and all kinds of stuff like that. So that's coming up a little bit later, maybe even before the end of this segment if we have time. We're going to get a head start on it. But first up with new business, James, you've been playing Darksiders 2, and I was not expecting this to ever come up in your lineup, so I'm very curious to find out how you came across this game. And you're playing this on Wii U, right?
Yes, I'm playing this on Wii U. I started playing it this week. I am through two dungeons at this point, I guess.
You're probably about as far as I got before I got pulled away by other things.
So, I mean, first off, the game itself, I know the first game was like Zelda as interpreted through the eyes of like Hot Topic. I mean, skulls and ravens and
Ronnie James Dio.
Yeah, I mean, it was like the Crow meets the Legend of Zelda.
Pretty much.
Yeah,
you know, so, some comic booky superhero kind of not. Yeah,
yeah,
you know.
a little bit, some goofiness in there. So, what I have found, having never played that game, knowing almost nothing about it beyond what's happened on the show and what I've seen, is that this game cares fuck all about people who haven't played the first game. It's just like, we're gonna drop you in the middle of the shit, just so you know.
Well, having beaten the first game, I can tell you it doesn't make a whole lot more sense that case.
Perfect.
Either.
Yeah. So
the story kind of sort of slowly starts to make sense as you get deeper into it. But yeah, in the beginning, it just goes.
It's just Death walks around and talks about how important he is, and everybody's like, "Yeah, you don't really matter that much." It's basically just a never-ending parade of death swinging his virtual dick around, and everybody else is like, get out of here, whatever. They don't care about you. Or them giving him, like, errands to run. Hey, I need you to go get this. I need you to go climb up that mountain, pull that chain, and then come back down. Why? Because maybe I'll help you later.
Sounds like a Zelda game.
Yeah, a bit. But in Zelda games, there tends to be a trinket you get on the other side that is intrinsically for Link. This seems much more of a, hey, if you help me out, maybe we can talk later. It seems more like Death's everybody's errand boy than freaking Death.
Yeah, that was Zach Miller's biggest complaint about the game, and he did really like it a lot, and he beat it, but he complained about that a lot. There's just kind of a narrative dissonance of this, you know, the super badass horseman of the apocalypse that you're playing as, and everybody treats him like a, you know,
like a punk,
just a servant. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, and even the characters that talk about how, well, you know, go do this for us, we can't do it, I can't fight you, one of them you can train against this big mountain, I guess they call them the Makers, this race that looks like trolls from Lord of the Rings, right up to Peter Jackson's, I mean, not trolls,
dwarves.
Yeah, they look like giant dwarves, and they even have the same architecture.
Yeah,
and they all talk about like, well, you need to go do it because we can't. You can train to fight against one of them, and he beats your ass. It's like, well, the fuck could you have done it, ass? The game doesn't do a very good job explaining the combat system. I didn't realize you could do sort of this reticule aiming for the stuff where you have to throw it until after I had already gone through the most infuriating process of trying to throw something at a target really far away with no success whatsoever.
Oh, yeah, because you have to click the stick, right?
Yeah, and it never tells you, hey, you can do this. So
yeah.
It's like I eventually just managed to get lucky on hitting it, but it took like 17 throws. I mean, it was awful. And then finally I just got lucky, and then all of a sudden I accidentally clicked the stick. I'm like, oh, fuck you, game. Fuck you so bad. So did you play it on the Wii U? I can't remember.
No, I got it on Steam. You know, I played several hours of it, and I was enjoying it, but I definitely had some of the same problems you are. It's a feeling of, I really don't know where I am or where I'm supposed to go. And, you know, one of the things that I do like about Zelda, as artificial as the worlds in Zelda can seem sometimes, it is pretty clear where you – in Zelda, it always feels like you can really tell what places are important and what places aren't. You know, right. Just the world is designed in that way. So when you're in an area that is really – just kind of a tangential place, you know, you might find a piece of heart if you really explore thoroughly, but it's not a critical part of the game. In Darksiders 2, there's something about the art style that is at once maybe more organic and believable in that, you know, not everything glows just because you need to do it.
Right.
But at the same time, it makes it pretty disorienting a lot of times riding around and trying to figure out what to do next. And the way the characters talk at you, there's never in parentheses, this is what this really means. So right. They'll talk to you about the Reckoner or, you know, the Destroyer or the cleaver, you know, the shadow cleaver or something. Right. It's like, is that a sword? Is that my little shirk and boomerang dealio? Is that the enemy? You know, it's like they have all these, you know, lavish comic booky kind of names for all this underworld mythology that they have going on, but there's never something in parentheses that tells you what that actually is. So unless you're totally obsessed with the mythology and you really understand the story, it's actually kind of confusing about like what characters actually want you to do sometimes. Right. They'll tell you to go to a place and you're like, I don't know where the fuck that is. And maybe you've even been there before, but you never picked up that was the name of that place that you were, or you just forgot, you know, and all the characters talk to you like you totally understand what's going on. And you as the player really don't.
Yeah. Death does, but the players don't. Right. It's a weird situation because Death pretty much knows everything going on in however many worlds we're dealing with here. That's never really clear to me either. Like, that you meet the makers who say they made all the worlds, and then they tell you that Earth is an absolute shit pile at this point.
Yeah, in the first game you play in post-apocalyptic Earth where all the humans have been made extinct.
Right.
So Earth has been, so you still see, you know, buildings and streets and sewers and old train stations, but they're all abandoned and now they're rampant with like demons and stuff. It's a very, very cool setting. But in Darksiders 2, it seems like from the very beginning of the game, you're kind of in this kind of other world.
Yeah.
And you've lost that sense of familiarity. Well, at least I know what this used to be. Now right. You're just kind of in this mythical place. It's maybe a little more like Zelda in that sense. It's an entirely fantasy world.
It's a lot like the world of Fable. I mean, that's, to me, that's what I think of when I look around. It's Fable's world. I mean, it's weird.
It's
because
less British.
Everybody talks about like how, oh God, Earth sucks right now. Like, Earth's fucked up. But you go to where the makers are and they're like, yeah, our world's pretty fucked up too. And you're like, seriously, it looks great. What? And I'm like, how many worlds are there? What are these worlds? Are they like metaphysical worlds? Are they actual, like, am I crossing the galaxy? What's going on right now?
It's a little bit like the Thor movie, I think.
Oh, okay.
You know, like it's kind of both. Like they're aliens, but they're also gods, but they're also from another dimension, but maybe it's a planet and
it's,
you know,
super confusing.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
But to the point of not understanding what to do, the very beginning, like the very first dungeon, maybe it's the second dungeon, when you meet the makers, one of them basically tells you to go to the forge. Mm-hmm. Right after she's finished telling you there are two forges. I'm like, which one? Which one do you want me to go to? There's two of them. We just talked about this. There's the little forge and there's the big forge. Where am I supposed to go right now? Because I don't understand. So I went to the big forge only to find that the door was locked for a reason that is not explained. And then I'm like, I guess I need to go to the little forge. So I hauled ass over there. And just like, yeah, this is where you're supposed to be the whole time. I'm like, great. Thanks, game. You did the best. I just want to know, you know, what the game's doing more than anything. Like, it's the combat's fine. There's a decent combo system, although mostly it seems like you spend most of the time just hitting and then jumping backwards and hitting and jumping backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't seem super skilled. And the game looks nice, and the enemies are, well, the bosses are pretty fun, but just the world doesn't feel consistent. It doesn't. It's huge, and it's a little bit of the first Assassin's Creedism going on, where you have to ride your horse across this really big open space with not a whole hell of a lot in it. It's not doing it for me because the dungeons aren't that great, and there's just not much going on outside of them.
Well, you know, I can't guarantee this, but in the first Darksiders, the dungeons got better and better and better as the game went on. They started to become more Zelda-like over time. They would, you know, they'd give you new powers that really changed how you play the game, and the puzzles would get very clever. I mean, there are puzzles in Darksiders that are up there with the best Zelda puzzles, just in terms of the way they make you use your abilities in really cool ways that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise. And they kind of lead you to the realization, oh, what if I did this, you know? And it's very, very cool. And the other cool thing about the dungeons in the first game is that they didn't look like dungeons, you know? It would be right, like an abandoned subway station. And it's still very, you know, it's very much a maze, and you still have a map, and you're still finding the boss key and all that kind of stuff. But it's just aesthetically, it's so very different from anything you would find in a Zelda game. The second one, I haven't seen that yet, you know, from the little I've played of it. I'm kind of hoping that they send you back to Earth at some point, because I like that part of it.
Yeah, the first two dungeons, at least, it's very much, you know, you go through a door, you go inside, you do stuff, you leave. And in fact, the dungeons themselves were pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I expect it will get better, but I don't know how much, you know, desire I'm going to have to just haul ass through it, because ultimately I don't care about anybody in this game or this world. There's some interesting stuff in it, but everybody's kind of an asshole, and Death is the least sympathetic character you could possibly make in a game.
Yeah, I mean, he is literally Death.
he is, I mean, the
it's
last
hard
game,
to be his friend, you know.
The last game was War, and you're like, War's kind of an asshole. Why would you want to be friends with that guy? Well, or Death, he's even worse.
Yeah,
like,
War is a teddy bear compared to Death.
Yeah, and he's got such a Prince of Persia, the Two Thrones vibe going on with his personality.
Oh, nice.
which is not something you want to be compared to. Like he's like, I'm Death. You should listen. And everyone's like, fuck you. I don't care.
Oh, you mean Warrior Within?
I'm Warrior Within. Yeah, it's a bad Warrior Within vibe. See, I've even blocked the name of that game out of my mind.
well done.
The music's a lot better than Warrior Within.
You don't like the Godsmack?
No, don't.
But it's pretty jarring, because he talks a big game and everybody's like, whatever. I don't know. It's weird. The whole
whatever,
thing.
Whatever, man. Go get me some flowers.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, okay, we'll help you undo what War did, but first you need to fill out these forms. And go over there and get them stamped and then come back. It's like, Is this an appeal for War's punishment, or are we just fucking around? I mean, because if we're just fucking around, fine. Whatever.
That's a fair criticism, but you know, it's funny you mentioned Prince of Persia and Assassin's Creed, because the one thing this game has a lot more than the first Darksiders is climbing.
There's
challenges.
A lot of climbing,
a lot of it, and it's pretty good. And the deeper I got into the game, the more challenging that stuff was, and the more, you know, the more exciting it was. The way they would build these very three-dimensional environments, and I had to figure out how to get across them. You know, gave me such a strong Prince of Persia vibe. It's one of the things I love about the, you know, the 3D Prince of Persia games.
Yeah, it's. The climbing isn't as fast, though, as some of the later Prince of Persia games, which sometimes it can feel kind of slow. You're like, all right, climb up this, climb up this. And the level design isn't quite as inventive so far. It's very much the same textures you're climbing across every time.
Yeah. I have a feeling if you stuck with it, James, you would appreciate it more, and you'd probably get to the better parts of the content. This probably comes later in the game, because I definitely felt that way about the first game as well.
I suspect I will. I feel like the game doesn't start great, and it's hard to make a game about Death.
Yeah,
it's hard to the point of maybe you should consider not doing it. Like maybe make it about a character who has to kind of have a working relationship with Death, but doesn't actually like the guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I wonder how different. You can probably speak to this, because I know War brandishes a big stupid sword.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Death has these two, I guess they're sickles.
Yeah.
Combat-wise, is it appreciably different?
You know, it's very similar, I guess.
Okay.
But I would say, you know, with the first Darksiders, the combat changes a good bit over the course of the game because you do unlock more abilities, and you also level up and gain, like in God of War, you gain souls or, you know, red things that allow you to buy new moves. Mm-hmm. And some of those are really useful, and some of them are kind of mobility upgrades. They let you dash in the air, and they let you do different things that let you change it up a lot. And, you know, although Darksiders, the first one, is primarily kind of like an adventure game like Zelda, it does have a stronger emphasis on combat. And especially in the second half of the game, there are times when they would put you in a combat situation that was pretty challenging. And I appreciated it because it forced me to use some abilities that I had kind of ignored up to that point. And I would find it really difficult, and I would get killed a couple times, but then I'd go back to it and I would just try to take a different approach, and it would work. So, you know, I didn't get far enough in Darksiders 2, but I would say, you know, in the beginning at least, it's pretty similar.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it feels like they should be different because of the difference in you know, their particular combat style, but I guess it doesn't really make a big difference.
Yeah, I think Death is a little more lumbering. I think he's kind of a bigger character, and...
Well, that's not good news. I thought the guy in the first game was slow as hell.
Yeah, well, you can overcome that with the weapons. So you can, you know, this game has loot drops, which is a new feature for them, and some enemies will drop new weapons or new sub-weapons, and you can use those and kind of alternate, you know, and be able to do things and kind of fit your preferred style a little bit better. And some of those weapons are, the possessed weapons are upgradable. And if you take the time to upgrade those by feeding them, it's a good system because what it lets you do is whenever you pick up basically junk weapons, you know, stuff that's way weaker than what you currently have and you would never use it, you can feed those to the possessed weapons to make those stronger. Hmm. And so over time you can get weapons that, you know, get a lot more powerful the more you pump into them. And that feels really good.
Yep. The only other thing I would want to add, because I guess I played the Wii U version, I might as well talk about it, is how it uses the tablet controller. So what it seems to be doing primarily is removing stuff off the HUD and transferring it down, which is fine. I mean, you can hot swap your weapons, your equipment from the tablet. I found it's very difficult to change what view the tablet has on it in game, though. So you can't just hit a button while you're moving to flip to the map. You have to go into the pause menu, scroll over to the map, which is also up moving the tablet along. And then unpause, which is, as far as I can tell, there may be some way of doing it, but if there is, it's definitely not clear.
Hmm.
It's kind of useful, and it's nice that they've freed up the screen real estate. And I believe you can play it entirely on the tablet if you want.
I think so.
But I think that just moves all the stuff down there, which is fine. It would just be nice if, I don't know, it let me just manage that screen a little bit better. So I could just scroll through stuff quickly. It's fine. Yeah. That's what I'll call it. It's fine. It's not, nobody's going to come back to this and go, this is a great implementation. They're going to say, okay, it works.
But I think that a lot of like off TV play, a lot of people like the off TV play feature, and that's a very basic feature of the Wii, but that's what the Wii U is all about, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, for the off play TV, that's fine. That works. I mean, there's no issue with that. It's just that it would be nice if the stuff where it's a combination of TV and tablet did a little more, or it's a little easier to flip through your menus, or you could do stuff without pausing the game very much.
Yeah, so it pretty much does exactly what you would expect.
Right, and it does the bare minimum of that.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I mean, it was a launch game, so that's not a huge shock. But I just, on the subject of off-TV play, it gets talked about a lot. I think it is something that most games should support, you know, unless there's something about the game that really does require you to have both screens, and we haven't really seen much of that yet.
Yeah.
Maybe a couple things in Nintendo Land. But for the most part, I think it's something that most games should try to support, but also say it's not something – to me, it's not a checklist thing that people should always talk about, because frankly, it's not useful to a lot of people. Hmm. Like, it's really good to have in there. It's a good thing. It's a good option for people to have, but – you know, there are plenty of people who are going to play Wii U games and almost never, ever, ever use that feature. For me, it's a gimmick because in my living situation, I just don't need it. It's not something that I would use. I'd rather play it on my big TV. And, you know, I'm not going to complain about people spending the resources to put this mode in. I think it's great that it's in there, but I'm not going to talk about that because I'm not going to use it. You know, and for some people, it's make or break. If the game doesn't have that, they basically can't play the game because they never have ownership of the television.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's weird given that, like, what is the average American household has 3 to 4 televisions now or something?
Yeah, something like
it's
that.
It's kind of a weird problem.
Japan, by myself.
It's more common, but anyway, you know, for
the,
some
the
people,
thing is,
it's
you,
very,
you would have,
very useful.
You would have, like, an HD TV that you hook all your consoles up to, right? That's where that would come into play.
And then maybe you have the old, you know, 1980s color box.
Yep.
That just has an antenna on it, and you only use it for Wheel of Fortune.
Yep.
Yeah, I understand that. So, John, what have you been playing this week, man?
Jason! I have been playing Heavy Rain for PS3. Picked it up on the cheap from GameStop, and I was always curious about this game. I was never really too interested in it when it came out. You know, there was a lot of talk about it, about what it was trying to do when it came out. So I was always kind of curious about it, but I was never interested enough to actually buy it when it first came out. So, but you know, I knew that they were trying to do some pretty, they were trying to do a lot of different stuff with this game, or at least so I thought. So where I am right now is I'm at the first crime scene. The whole plot of the game, for those that don't know, I feel like this is probably a spoiler for absolutely nobody. It's about a serial killer. It's a serial killer who kills children. And of course, they set the game up. You start off as a guy with two sons, and you know, the family goes out to the mall. His one son runs away.
No, wait. First, you play in the yard. Then you shave yourself.
Hold on. I'm skipping some stuff, but I'll get to that.
Tell me about the showers, John.
I'll get to that. So you go to the mall. And your son runs away from you, and that's where, you know, you go chasing after him, and, you know, he runs in front of a car and gets killed, and, you know, the guy's really guilty, et cetera, et cetera. And then also the other storyline, there's actually several storylines kind of going at once all surrounding this killer, but the other storyline...
Yeah, you play as different characters.
Yeah.
They kind of swap around.
Yep. You also play as this kind of one private eye sort of guy who's trying to figure out what's going on with this killer. Then you also play as an FBI detective. So there's several different kind of characters and storylines that you switch in between. So it's interesting because, like Guillaume talked about, at the very start, I thought about this because at the start, there's a lot of things in this game that you can make fun of. And there's a lot of things that are at first glance silly and ridiculous. Like the tutorial at the start of the game, it has you waking up as this, you know, guy who's, you know, he's just your regular dad in the suburbs, walking around his house, and the tutorial at the start of the game is you getting up out of bed, taking a pee, having a shower, and then changing. Right? And what I thought was interesting, at first I was like, this is completely ridiculous, because the controls with it, and one of the things that I'm going to talk about is the move controls, but the normal controls, which is with your DualShock controller, they have you doing stuff like brushing your teeth, and, you know, you shake your controller up and down, and I'm sitting there like, come on, this is ridiculous. Like, I mean, it's totally ridiculous, right? You know? But it's what it's...
Brush the teeth, John, or your teeth will fall. Brush them. Brush them right now.
The thing is, but what it's effective in doing
is... I wish it made you floss.
It's that, it would not... Honestly, it would not have surprised me if it would have
you
made you do that.
You have to kind of move it back and forth in front of your mouth.
Yeah, maybe if I go back and play that part of the game with move controls, maybe it'll force you to floss, but I don't know. But yeah, so they make you. But what that's effective in doing is letting you know that, hey, this is more of a, this is not a Michael Bay action movie that's been translated into a video game. This is actually a game about realish characters doing real things in the real world, right? So I thought that was effective, even though the way they go about it, I don't know if that was the best way to do it.
Well, Bad Boys has real characters in the real world.
Well, Bad Boys the video game, probably not. But, you know, that's the thing. It does flesh out...
the Bad Boys there are the people who made it.
It does flesh out the characters and kind of makes you... fleshing out the characters, really. I mean, if you play with a character brushing their teeth, you're not really fleshing out anything. But it kind of makes them feel more like real characters doing real things in a real world. On some level. I don't think they were totally successful, but
it's the sort of establishing stuff you get in movies. You don't get it in games because people don't sit there with the intention of trying to learn about, you know, Jim Carrey's role in this particular film. They're this game. They just want to get going.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's sort of slowing the pace of the game down and not skipping over anything. Because that's what a lot of games do. They skip over the boring parts of life. Certain part of Heavy Rain is about the boring parts of life. That's kind of the experience of the game. Not that it's necessarily boring.
Also skipping over the important parts of the story where it makes sense.
Well, I haven't gotten there yet, so I can't really speak on that necessarily. So like I said, the part that I'm at now is where I've just played as the FBI detective. I've gone through the first crime scene and, you know, looked at the body and done all that kind of stuff. But it was interesting because at first I wasn't going to try the move controls. Maybe I should back up a little bit and talk about
those were patched in after the game came out.
Yeah, because I got the director's cut.
I think almost a year after the game came out.
It was a lot later. Yeah,
it was a lot later.
Move wasn't even launched when this game first came out.
Nope.
Yeah. So I got the director's cut, which was released later. And so it has all of that and it has some of the DLC. But generally what you do is you go around, you walk around, you walk around the house, you walk around outside, you know, you talk to different characters, getting clues, and you kind of look around the environment and get clues that way. And it's kind of guided a lot of the time. You can bring up what your character is thinking about, and then you can kind of click to hear his thoughts, which sometimes can be pretty funny because sometimes it's just what he'll say is so canned. Maybe I should go over here and fix a sandwich. It's just so ridiculous, right? So with the move controls, at first I wasn't going to try them because a lot of the stuff that you're doing is pretty silly. So it's not like I'm looking for a better way. Like I talked about brushing my teeth with the character. Doing that a different way isn't adding anything to the experience, right? You know, shaking the move controller up and down is no better than shaking the DualShock up and down. So I wasn't really looking to, you know, kind of swap that out. I didn't think it would really improve things at all. And so, but Neil asked me, Neil Ronahan, the director of Nintendo World Report, he asked me, he said, hey, have you tried the move controls? Because he said that he was considering, you know, getting the game as just something to try out because I think he recently got a move controller. And I would not recommend it because the move controls, the way that they implement them. Now, I will say a couple of caveats is that I didn't go through the tutorial with the move controls. So a lot of the stuff I was kind of backtracking and figuring out how to do stuff that I had already learned with the DualShock and kind of trying to figure out what the different icons meant because a lot of the icons are very vague. Like you're not sure if you should hold the move controller upright and push it upwards or push it forwards. Because a lot of the icons are very vague. It's just the move controller with an arrow pointing up. You know, it's kind of, you have to interpret it. But I think that's, you know, you can kind of get over that once you learn what the icons mean. But the toughest thing that I encountered was the way that with certain things, they'll string movements so that to accomplish something. So on the first crime scene, you have to climb up to the top of a highway. And to do that, you have to, you walk up to this hill. And there's kind of three different points where you have to put different move controls in, different combos of move controls. And so to get up on the first part of the hill, you have to like press X, then push the move controller forward, then push it over to the left, and then like turn it to the right or something like that. So by the time you wind up at the next part of the hill, it's like, you know, you're like standing on one foot, rubbing your belly, patting your head. It's just kind of ridiculous. It's a poor way to do it. And of course, if you mess up at all, which is incredibly easy to do with the move controls, because I mean, I'm definitely not in the proper environment for, you know, I'm only about 3 or 4 feet away from my screen in this tiny room. You know, I'm not really, it's not the ideal move control environment. So, you know, I'm screwing up the controls all the time. So I sat there and forced myself to climb up this hill with move controls. And even though there were several times where I almost just said, fuck this. This is just ridiculous and so annoying. It took me probably about 10 minutes to just crawl up the hill because I would crawl up, screw up one move, fall back down. Then I'd finally make it. Then I would try several more times, fall back down. And finally, I made it up the top. But I'm switching back to the DualShock controls just because the MoveShock controls are so annoying.
That part is hard even with a normal controller if it makes you feel any better. It's kind of frustrating.
Yeah, I was going to say. I think that's a part where I switched the controls to easy.
Yeah.
I want to imagine that the camera that the Move uses was actually secretly filming John and posting it to YouTube.
Yeah, it's that's the thing. I didn't like freak out or anything, but I was just like, wow, this is just a bad intro to putting something like early on in the game like that. I don't think it was a good call to put something that complicated that early in the game because it was pretty annoying.
Sure. Yeah.
Pretty annoying. But yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying it so far. It's kind of, I felt like they sort of put the controls in. I feel like they kind of wanted to make an interactive movie, but then just kind of tried to like gamify it a bit and throw in a bunch of stuff that was sort of gamey to make it like a game so they could call it a game.
I think the stated goal was to eventually sort of make the controls feel so natural and so, you know, mimetic to what that action really would be, to translate that very smoothly to something you can actually do on a controller that you didn't really think about playing it anymore, and you just kind of behaved as if you,
right. The
you
game
know, you
said
just
brush
kind
your
of,
teeth and you brushed your teeth.
Well, yeah. It's just that you would put yourself in that character's shoes and really, you know, not worry about playing a game, but just kind of live out the story and make all the choices you want to make. But I think when they make you jump around among, you know, several different characters, it's a lot harder to really associate yourself that intimately and sort of lose yourself in the character.
Yeah.
And for me, I actually really enjoyed the story of Heavy Rain until the end. And I think the end is absolute horse shit. But I still enjoyed the game overall. I think I rented it from Gamefly at the time, but I was pretty happy with it overall. And their new game, Beyond Two Souls, that's coming out this year on PS3, I'm very curious to see what they learned from Heavy Rain, because I enjoyed Indigo Prophecy quite a bit.
Yeah, but like they learned a lot from Indigo Prophecy, I thought. So I've got kind of high hopes for their next game. Because, like Indigo Prophecy,
too.
Like the movements that you had to do on the controller had nothing to do with what was happening on the screen.
Yeah.
Nothing.
And that game's story is even far more ridiculous than Heavy Rain. So
they're
moving in the right direction, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like exactly. That was kind of my takeaway. It's like there's some flaws with it, but I like where they're going with it. I like what they're trying to do because I think more games like this kind of need to be made. Like just more games. I think to me this is a mature game. This is any first person shooter, that's not a mature game. This is a mature game to me. You know, it deals with real themes. It tries to present them.
Eat my maturity!
Well, it tries to present, you know, real themes and, like, you know, real kind of dark themes or, like, you know, issues like, I mean, even not even, like, you know, obviously the serial killer stuff is, you know, that's kind of out there. But, you know, also, like, you know, deals with, like, stuff like, you know, divorce, and it deals with stuff like parents trying to relate to their children when their children don't really like them. It deals with kind of like real sort of life issues like that, which I think is interesting, kind of refreshing.
Yeah, but it does have some flaws in its script, I think, that just kind of make that a little bit less effective than it should be.
Yep.
So yeah, like it might be mature for a game, but then you compare that to basically any thriller, which usually have those elements. Like, I mean, you're supposed to feel for the detective and for the victim and hate the killer. And, like, it's a genre that's pretty much by the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, like, don't expect the game to have, like, a story that could have won an Oscar or anything like that.
Yeah.
But for a game, it's pretty evolved, I suppose.
Yeah. For me, it's kind of hard to – it feels a lot like Grand Theft Auto 4 sometimes. I just kind of get that feeling. I have kind of flashbacks to Grand Theft Auto 4 where you're sort of with your guy, you know, walking through this, you know, your stiffly animated character walking through this city with random people walking around saying random things, kind of, you know. So, but I mean, I like it. I'm enjoying it so far, though. It's a good game.
Awesome. I'm glad you're checking it out, John. All right, so I'm going to go up in new business next, and this will not take too long. I've actually been trying to work on Luigi's Mansion, Dark Moon, and I'm not done with it yet, but I'm traveling this weekend, so I should have plenty of time to finish it for next episode. And I did finish the last story last week, but, you know, I was practically finished with it last week when I talked about it. So the main thing I've been playing new this week is a little game called Joe Danger the Movie. And I got it for free on PlayStation Plus. And the only reason I wanted to bring it up is because it reminds me so much of Moto Heroes, the WiiWare game that we did for Retroactive about a year ago now.
Mm.
And, you know, Moto Heroes is a very interesting game, a very flawed game. I thought we had pretty good discussions on it. And Joe Danger, the movie, which is actually the sequel to the first Joe Danger, which I've really have not played, but it's very well thought of. The sequel didn't get nearly as much attention. I think it kind of took a long time to come out, and I don't know how many people played it. But, you know, it really does remind me a lot of Moto Heroes. It's like a 2D side-scrolling. It looks like a racing game, but it's really not a racing game. It's really more of a platformer where you're mostly moving forward, but you can also go backwards. And, you know, when you jump, you have a lot of ridiculous air control that you use to, like, you know, make precision landings on things. And mm-hmm. sometimes you're, like the basic gameplay. And I think most of the first, Joe Danger was just you on a bicycle. It was this kind of Evel Knievel parody.
Yeah.
And in this game, the idea is that he's become a movie star. And so it lets them use a lot of different, you know, environments and make it look really crazy and have things chasing you. So you have to go fast all the time. A lot of those stages are really frustrating when there's something chasing you and you have a, you know, just like in Moto Heroes, whenever the goal of the level was just to get to the end as fast as possible, that's where the game really broke down and the mechanics no longer served the player anymore. When it's more about just kind of make your way through this, try not to crash, try to find all the secret things, that can be a lot of fun. And Joe Danger yeah. works the same way. So, you know, they also have quite a few jetpack levels, and the jetpack mechanics are very, very simple, but they are pretty fun to control. And those levels are a little more open because you have so much more freedom of movement. So they can hide things in some really clever places. And, you know, kind of the surprising thing to me is that, you know, it did remind me of Moto Heroes, which is not a game I thought I would ever really think about again.
me and neither.
I enjoyed it enough, you know, but it's just not the most memorable or notable game. But this game also reminds me of the early Tony Hawk games, because they kind of challenge you to, you know, you go through these levels and they're usually 2 or 3 minutes long. You know, they're pretty short levels. There's maybe 40 of them in the game. And they give you several different goals. So one of the goals is just survive until the end of the level. Another one is get there in a certain amount of time. Another one is collect all the letters that spell danger. Another is find the secret stars that are just hidden around the level. Another is keep a trick going and combo all the way through the level. Those are really hard to do.
But those are all objectives that you have within a single level, right?
That's right. Yeah. And you actually right. get a bonus if you can pull all of them in one run. But that's very hard to do in some cases. And a lot of times you would just play the level 2 or 3 times and try to get them one by one, which again, just reminded me a lot of the early Tony Hawk games where you'd have the skate park and it's not a race. It's just this kind of open thing, but they give you objectives and the objectives are very varied. So some of them are very trick based. Some of them are you're just trying to get to a certain place or just look for a secret thing. You know, some of them are just do a very specific kind of trick. And just try to get it on all the different ramps before the timer runs out. So there's just a lot of cool little things like that, and they keep mixing it up. And, you know, overall, I thought the game was pretty fun. It definitely got frustrating in a few places, but it's short. If you have PlayStation Plus, I think it's still free. I think you can probably still get it for maybe at least another week or two. And, you know, I thought it was time well spent. So especially if you were a big fan of Moto Heroes, I know that game had kind of a mixed reaction, but if you did really enjoy that, this is well worth checking out.
Like, you can't overstate just how much more control you have in the air with in Joe Danger. Like, you can actually, like, you could go, you know, forward and then go back and then forward again and then back.
Sure.
A particularly high jump.
You can actually jump straight yeah. up and then start moving horizontally at the peak of your jump.
Yeah.
I mean, it physically makes no sense whatsoever,
no.
but it makes the game more fun.
Yeah, and like, whereas in Moto Heroes, basically once you left the ground, your fate was sealed. You know, like you,
yeah,
you
most
went
of the time,
where
yeah.
you had to go. Yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah, that game's much more momentum based,
mm-hmm.
which makes the platforming pretty frustrating in a lot of cases. Like, it controls like a racing game, but it's designed like a platformer. You know, that was one of our big problems with Moto Heroes, is that they ask you to do all this really cool stuff in the environment, but it's actually very difficult to do with the controls they give you. So Joe Danger is more of a true platformer. It still looks like a racing game, but it's really nothing of the sort. And it's got a neat kind of sense of humor, and, you know, they put you in this kind of Indiana Jones setting, and then you're kind of this James Bond setting where you're on skis and you're trying to destroy missiles. It's very goofy, but it's a fun little game. And Guillaume is going to go last for new business.
As a follow-up to last week's retroactive, I have gone through Mega Man 3 once again, properly this time, without using the save states. Wow. So I finally feel better about myself.
Feel like a man, Guillaume?
Yeah, I didn't sleep until the weekend, you know, it was just like it was keeping me up at night, but now I can rest. Unfortunately, since basically like the rest of the game was, I guess, in a way spoiled for me, you know, it was so much easier to go back and to just play through it. Hmm. But I actually then started Mega Man 4. And played through that.
You're a wild
and,
man.
You know, without looking up like the weaknesses, except for Wily at the end, because I really didn't want to lose against him. But yeah, like it was a much more fun experience just going through the game without save states and just like discovering the game as I go, familiarizing myself with the checkpoints and the areas where I thought like, okay, like if I save Toad Man for a time when I'm, you know, I'm weak, during the bus rush at the end, you know, like I can kind of gain back some health there, and because he's easy to beat. And there's this other boss, a Pharaoh Man, just, you know, like he basically can't move when you use the right weapon against him. So like he figuring little tricks like that I could exploit and then beating the game. So that was pretty satisfying. And then, you know, I may or may not have already started Mega Man 5. Maybe more on that next week. I don't know.
Are you, did you get these all on what? On Wii Virtual Console?
No, I'm a strong believer in not paying too many times for the same shit. Sure. So I own the collection. I'm going to play it, damn it, even though the emulation sucks. And my main PlayStation 2 controller is broken.
Is it some Nyko bullshit?
No, it's a Logitech wireless controller, which has a very loose D-pad, and I've never liked the analog buttons for this type of game, and it's just, yeah, it works, but, you know, sometimes I cheated, I used the triangle button to auto-fire. You know, it's much faster, it's much simpler. Otherwise, like, sometimes, like, the Mega Man would just take an extra step when I didn't want him to, or, you know, like, he would shoot twice when I was shooting once. Like, it's not that great a controller.
Brutal.
Yeah.
You're a real trooper, you know. I'm not actually not that surprised that you've continued to play more Mega Man, because after we did the retroactive last week, I started to think, like, you know, it's been a long time since I played Mega Man 2. And they just put out the first Mega Man on Wii U Virtual Console. That's one of the early releases for that platform. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking when they bring out Mega Man 2, I might go ahead and pick that up. Because I don't think I ever bought it on Wii. Like the anniversary collection was still too fresh for me at that time. But at this point, it's been a long time since I played Mega Man 2. And I'm like, you know, that's a game that I can like kind of run through in about 90 minutes. Kind of, you know, it's like similar to Super Metroid. It's a lot shorter than Super Metroid, but it's a game that I like having very quick access to, because it's a game I might actually play all the way through multiple times, just kind of out of nostalgia or just to kill an afternoon.
Right.
Very few games fit that criterion for me, but Mega Man 2 is up there. Yeah. I just keep thinking about Bubble Man.
Why?
Because it's my favorite. It's my favorite Mega Man stage.
Who wouldn't think about Bubble Man?
It's my favorite Mega Man stage and maybe my favorite Mega Man song.
Oh, Bubble Man. He's so dreamy.
Yeah. Oh, that guy, I tell you, he's a hunk.
I'm about it.
And yeah, the other main game that I've been playing is Art Style Acquia.
I would guess Acquia.
Acquia. Or Acquite in Europe. For those European out there. So yeah, this is one of the free games from Club Nintendo for the month of May. So let me tell you if you should spend 100 coins on it or not. The game is, like when the art style games came out, I was really a big fan of them, and I was, you know, I became a fan of Skip as a developer, and you know, they all had like this kind of weird. Like, they all are based on weird ideas, right? Like, you've got Box Life, in which you cut up boxes. You know, it's absolutely absurd, but, you know, like, it's $5 and, you know, whatever. But Aquia is one of the games that I did not pick up for $5 because it was a little bit, it seemed a little bit too mundane. The game is very much a match three puzzle game. And, like, you've got this column of blocks, and you have you can choose at the beginning of the game, like you can have different pieces that you insert into that column. It can be like either 1x1x2, 2x1, or 2x2. And so you've got this block on the side of the column, and you just press A, and you basically push it inside the column, and basically like two other pieces come out from the other side of the column. So you're just like moving pieces left and right, you know, through the column, trying to match, you know, three of the same color together. And, while that happens, you've got a little bit, you've got a little diver dude who's, just like going, you know, further and further down the ocean. And so, you know, you match pieces and you try to make combos, and the more combos you make, the faster the little guy descends. And, shadows creep up at the edge of your vision. Your breathing becomes shallow. You can't really catch your breath. You don't know why. And you hear a thud. And, you know, at some point you realize it's the sound of your own heart beating. And you start panicking because you really can't breathe anymore. And you just withdraw the diving mask. And immediately, you know, water fills your lungs. And it's just, you know, slow agonizing death, and eventually children playing on the beach find your body and throw rocks at it before telling their parents. So that's Artsaw Aquia.
Sounds lovely.
Seriously though, you've got like your progress is represented by this little diving guy, and as he descends, and as time goes on, the upper part of the column of blocks starts fading away, and you very much start hearing, you know, kind of a ta-dum, ta-dum, like this very, very unnerving music that does resemble like a beating heart. And like more and more of the column fades, and it's just the most unpleasant feeling ever. And that's really like that's what they're trying to evoke. Like your little guy is actually drowning out there, unless you do some combos and push those blocks. It's very distressing.
It sounds kind of like Mr. Driller, but way more intense.
Yeah, well, you know, like I made up the parts about the kids throwing rocks at your bloated body, but you know, like it's that's where your imagination takes you, right? Like it's just like it's not very pleasant. But unfortunately, like, mechanically, it's a very, very standard game, and, you know, I feel pretty good about the fact that I didn't pay $5 for it. Do I recommend picking it up for 100 coins? It's, personally, yes, because I, you know, like, depending on how many coins you have to spend on this, I mean, I think it's worth checking out, and I, you know, like, what else are you going to spend your coins on, really? Like, I don't understand people who don't buy these digital games with their coins, because there's nothing else. Like, it's the, you know, like, you gain these from buying games, and you're getting games for it. That's awesome.
It is awesome. But some people do like to save up for, you know, bags or, you know,
yeah,
game carrying cases and t-shirts and stuff like that.
Yeah, so yeah, it's understandable.
I understand that. Those take a lot more coins, but I agree. Yeah. The downloadable stuff is very tempting, and I'm hoping that program's going to continue and also expand over time.
Yeah, to Wii U.
You know, and on Wii U especially, now that the Virtual Console is out, they've got a lot more fodder to support that as well. So over time, I'm looking forward to that whole feature becoming more valuable over time. And you know, I just got 60 coins for downloading the free version of Tank Tank Tank.
Yeah.
So I got coins to burn, baby.
Oh, there are plenty of ways to game the system. But yeah, like I guess like if you really want to know if I recommend it or not, like the fact is I'm probably not going back to this game. Like it's, you know, it's interesting, but eventually, like as, you know, like eventually I just found my, I can't really find myself getting better at the game. Like it's very, very tough. And eventually when like most of the column fades away, you don't really see what you're saying, what you're doing. And you're just like, I was just like going up and down the column, mashing A, trying to randomly make combos to try to, you know, get myself out of that situation. So yeah, like I'm sure there's a strategy to the game, but I'm not the type of person who's going to spend that much time trying to find it. So yeah, unless you're really nuts about Mesh 3 puzzle games. Yeah, I don't know. Don't pay for it at any rate.
All right, cool, man. So everybody check that game out. And now we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to squeeze in as much listener mail as humanly possible into one segment. Stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, first up we have a review of Mario and Donkey Kong Minis on the Move for 3DS by Neil Ronahan. These Minis games keep coming, but this time it's more of a varied experience with new gameplay modes that Neil really enjoys, although the concept runs a bit short over time. I'm sorry.
Minis.
Get it?
Yeah, we have review revisists, as it's written here.
Yeah, yeah.
Professor Layton and the Miracle Mask. The staff takes another stab at evaluating this puzzle-encrusted, completely impossible tale, with the benefit of both perspective and more voices. Here's a puzzle. If two reviewers give a game a 7.5, one gives a game an 8. Who ate my slice of cake? Correct, I did.
I've got it!
We have a staff roundtable on Shadow of the Eternals. So a spiritual successor for Eternal Darkness has been announced for the Wii U. This, of course, means not only discussion of a well-loved Nintendo game, but also a potential baggage attached. You should really go see what our staff had to say to one another about it, because there's certainly no way you're going to be hearing about this for 20 minutes in about an hour.
And finally, we have a review for Kung Fu Rabbit on the
Wii U
eShop by Zach Kaplan. Can rabbits kung fu? No, of course not. However, they can platform, and Kung Fu Rabbit, it turns out, is a challenging platformer that lets you control how far you jump by how long you hold down the button. It turns out it's a pretty good game, replete with rabbit iconography.
I've heard it called, like, some sort of Super Meat Boy Light.
Weird.
I know.
That's Super Meat Boy Cute.
Super Meat Cute.
Oh! Super right. Cute Meat?
Well, no! No, John!
Don't
no!
go there!
No!
You can get even more atrocious puns and wonderful original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
That is the worst thing you've ever said, Linderman.
I only provide original content.
Welcome back, everyone. It's time for listener mail, and oh my goodness, is it ever. We are so far behind. We have some amazing emails we've been gathering up lately, and I really hope we're going to get through a lot of them here. Who knows? Who can say? We do it all live. We don't know. But James has the first email.
I do have the first email, and the first email is from Austin, and he writes because it is an email. We didn't get to hear him say it. I have been listening to old Radio Free Nintendo episodes. In the episode 135, the gang was discussing the concept of death in games, specifically relating to Mad World. Johnny said that he thinks there had been at the time, no games that treated the idea of death as something serious with real consequences. And I was curious about two things. One, do any of you think that there have been games released since the taping of episode 135 that have taken death seriously? 135 was released in March of 2009. Two, how about Fire Emblem Awakening? I think the whole series has done a great job of taking death extremely seriously, treating it like something with real, tangible gameplay and emotional consequences.
It's funny because I haven't played Fire Emblem Awakening, but I just read this review on Grantland, and a guy was describing how Crom lost his wife and his child in the same battle, and then just carried on.
Yeah, so, well, people don't die in that game, in those games, not usually. They usually become just too injured to carry on.
That's right. What I was going to ask about. Like, people always talk about characters dying, and it has a gameplay consequence because you can't use them anymore after that. But in the story, they don't completely go away in most cases, right?
Well, it depends. I mean, there are characters that die as a story conceit, and yeah, they go away. But a lot of times, I mean, there's only a handful of characters in a Fire Emblem game that are truly significant to the plot line.
Yeah.
And the majority of them are in a cannot die state. So if they die, you lose the mission. So really, it's just these characters that in the previous had been sort of in the secondary background, you know, maybe dropping one-liners or, you know, you got support conversations with them or stuff. They go away in that construct. That, you know, you meet with them after the battle and they're like, hey, I'm sorry, I can't go on. And it's like, it's fine, you know, just take care of yourself. We'll finish this.
I don't know why I'm thinking this. But you know what game I wish would introduce the concept of death, because I think they would do it well? Animal Crossing.
That would be a little harsh for that
game.
That's
really interesting, though.
I think, you know, like, you could lose a neighbor. You know, you would go to the wake at a certain time.
Like Animal Crossing funerals. Seriously, that would be crazy.
Yeah, it would be crazy. That's true.
you would go to another neighbor's house. They would, you know, be sitting at their kitchen table.
You would dig up their yard, and you would chop down their trees. It's like, well, you're not going to need these apples anymore.
They would have a public auction for their belongings.
Like, it's a game all about permanence, right? And, like, you've got people moving out and stuff like that. Why not death?
Well, you know, moving out in a way is death in that game. I mean, they're gone. And a lot of times there's a relatively emotional period after you find out they're leaving where, you know, your character reacts strongly to it. Other characters in town react strongly to it. The person who's leaving reacts, and there's a period after they've packed up their house and all that's in there are boxes.
People still talk about them, like the other residents.
Well, you still talk about people when someone dies in your life, do they just don't talk about them anymore? They're dead.
No, I know, but Animal Crossing does this. Like you'll talk to the other neighbors and they're just like, "Oh, I miss so and so."
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot like what happens when someone dies. I mean, them leaving when the house is finally empty. But it's not. But they're. It's not gone yet. It's just empty.
Yeah.
That's sort of your wake moment where you sit there and you go.
Yeah. There's a sense of loss.
Yeah. And especially if it's a character you really liked, you're just like, oh man, they're leaving. Why are you leaving? I miss you.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, I guess really it depends on how you define, you know, how you define taking death seriously, right? Do you mean does it have an effect on, like, you know, like in Fire Emblem? Does it make the game harder? Or do you take it from the standpoint of, like, how it affects characters in the story, how it's treated? I mean, Heavy Rain would be a game that takes death very seriously, or at least tries to present it in a serious manner,
right?
And presents its consequences to the characters in the game in a serious manner.
It tries, and it's one thing I really like about Heavy Rain is that it is ambitious and it has that goal in mind. I don't think it really pulls it off very well ultimately.
It's difficult to do.
But it's trying to do it. Well, in fact, the game that I think I've played since then that really proves to me that it is possible and that, well, I always knew it was possible. I just wasn't sure if anybody was ever going to really try it. The one game that I think has totally done it and really effectively is To the Moon.
Yes. Yeah.
But
see,
here's the question, though. When we talk about taking death seriously, do we mean taking it seriously as a story conceit or taking it seriously as a consequence of gameplay?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Because in both of those examples, while they take death very seriously, in so seriously as Heavy Rain takes anything, there's nothing you can do to avoid the deaths. They are story conceits. And like JRPGs have been killing characters for a while.
Sure.
And emotionally affecting the player through that mechanism.
Or trying to. I mean, like, you know, stuff like Aeris, you know. I mean, certainly some people are emotionally impacted by things like Aeris dying. And you know, depending on the age you are when you play that game or how seriously you're taking the rest of the story.
Ahead of time. I think the suddenness of it is really the more impacting thing. If you knew ahead of time, you probably aren't affected by it as much.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good point.
Because it takes you by surprise, and it is permanent.
Yeah, she ain't coming back.
She's sitting there praying, and you've accomplished your mission. Like, this is the end of the game. You had to get her here, and you have. And then all of a sudden, bang, sword through the chest. I mean, it's very sudden if you don't know what's coming.
I plan on playing this game soon, so thanks for the spoiler.
But to me, all those JRPG characters are kind of silly and interchangeable to a certain degree. So
it depends on the game. There are some games that are less so than others. I mean, really, I can't think of a game that really even addresses the concept of a character dying as a consequence of your actions to an extent, like the Ogre Battle games do. Mm-hmm. In that, well, but they may come back as ghosts or angels or demons or whatever. But I mean, they do die.
But are they really characters though?
Some of them are. I mean, there are characters who have talking roles that you can become attached to who buy it. Okay. I mean, anybody but Magnus can die in that game. Anybody.
Remember that this discussion was born out of talking about Mad World, which is not a game that I feel the need to say much more about. But that is an action game. And I think the context at the time on episode 135, all those lifetimes ago, was probably, you know, in reference to action games. And Mad World is, you know, a game where you literally just kill people every 2 seconds. I mean, that is the game. That's the
With
point, is to kill people in the most ridiculous way
Is there
way
consequence
possible.
To you killing things is the question.
Yeah.
Not consequence to people around you dying.
Right. So I was thinking you know, like a shooter game or a stealth game where if you kill someone, it fundamentally changes the rest of the game because now you are a murderer. You know, where not just a Metal Gear Solid game where technically you can beat the game without killing anyone, but that's just because you shoot him with a tranquilizer instead of a pistol.
I mean,
like, it doesn't really matter.
In the Elder Scrolls games, you can kind of have that where you become a murderer if you kill somebody. I think in the towns, you can become a murderer and you get thrown in jail.
It depends on the situation, right? Yeah. If you see someone in a cave, you can kill them. No one will ever know. But if you're in front of a lot of other people and you do it, then you become notorious.
You will get consequences.
But also, you become notorious, and then there's always a mechanic that you can do to make that go away. Just like in Grand Theft Auto, you get the stars, and then you go into a pay-in spray, and you come out, and it's clean, and everyone's kind of forgotten that it ever happened.
Right. Yep. You killed 48 people, but it's fine. It's fine. Everything's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to do this in a game because ultimately, what you're trying to do is you're trying to make it so living in the game's world is less enjoyable because. But by killing someone, you've essentially made it so now you have to essentially struggle against your reputation as a murderer.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, the only game that I could think of that even attempts to do something similar to this sort of branding you for your crimes, weirdly enough, is Link's Awakening, in which you can steal. But it literally changes your name to Thief.
I like that example.
And the guy you stole from kills you the next time he sees you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's some real consequences.
Everybody calls you Thief from that point forward.
Yep.
It's the only game I could think of that puts you know, a metaphorical scarlet letter on you for doing bad shit. So wait, when did this email come out?
A couple weeks ago, maybe.
No. When did the initial conversation? Excuse me.
Oh, March of 2009.
There is, I mean, to an extent, the decisions that you make in games like Mass Effect, although late in the series, fuck that.
Yeah.
I mean. There are things where, like, deciding to save one race versus another.
Yeah.
Where
these are all ideas, though, that were around in Western RPGs forever.
They are.
Forever,
you're right.
Though.
They are. And the actual, like, branding what you're doing as having negative repercussions is not something that's broached in games because ultimately it's very difficult to make that a fun experience.
Yeah.
Yes, you could make killing toadies, an emotional experience, something where you have to deal with the fact that you've just done something that you wouldn't want to do under normal circumstances. Your hands are now stained. But it doesn't make for enjoyableness. I think ultimately it's there are games that feel like they drag you through the gutter. And they make you hurt. They make you upset. They do things to you knowing that you're not enjoying it, but you're not like, yeah, this is great. You're feeling the pain of the ride.
Yeah.
But it's difficult for games to attempt to do that, especially in an action title, because
yeah, we're not going to see that in a AAA game, basically.
Well, one place where I thought it was actually, I think it was in Modern Warfare 2, there was one, in terms of showing the impact of death, And this was a place where I never would have thought, I mean, I never would have thought I would have seen this in that type of game. But there's one place where one of the plot lines is, you know, terrorists, they steal a nuke. And so your guys are trying to prevent this. And, you know, you have one of the characters, because the way that game works is you kind of switch between these different groups of army guys that are, you know, battling at different parts of the globe. And so what happens is, like, a nuke is set off and your guys are caught kind of in at ground zero. So they're dead. They're done. And it shifts over to the other team. But before it does that, it shifts to one of the guys that's caught at ground zero after the bomb has gone off. And this has nothing to do. It doesn't affect anything else in the rest of the game. But it shows him dying. So
yeah,
it has
in the first game.
Yeah, is it the first game? Yeah, it's really creepy. Yeah. It's like you're crawling along the ground and you're like kind of trying to get to just something and then you just die. And I was just like, what the fuck? Where the hell did that come from? That was really creepy. That was really, really weird. And I was just, it's really impactful and it's kind of like stuck with me because it was such a weird sort of creepy, like, this your guy died and he didn't just die. This is actually how he died and let us show you how he struggled and then expired.
Yeah.
It was pretty creepy.
What about like Spec Ops?
You know, Spec Ops. So a couple of us have been playing it recently, and I'm not finished with it. So I don't want to hear any spoilers or anything. But that's a game that certainly deals with headier topics than your average military shooter. But it is a game where you shoot 1,000 dudes who all look the same.
Yes.
And your characters don't seem all that affected by it. They comment on it occasionally, like, wow, this is really fucked up. But then they go and shoot another 100 dudes. So it's kind of trying to have it both ways, kind of like Uncharted and Tomb Raider and all those games. Where it's like, you've got this, they're trying to portray this very realistic human character who has real emotions and has reactions to the things going on around them. But then they seem to get numb to it very quickly. Whew. All right. So we got to move on to lighter topics. So John's going to read the next email.
Steven writes, 24 minutes of Donkey Kong's bongo bullshit is 23 too many. Nobody gives a fuck. Please talk about Urban Champion for 24 minutes next time. It's just as relevant. Get it? Donkey wrong.
Donkey wrong.
Wow. He's referring to the episode 2 weeks ago, right, where we discussed Donkey Kongo. What am I saying?
Donkey Kong Jungle Beat.
Yes.
We mentioned Donkey Kongo, but mostly James had been playing Donkey Kong Jungle Beat.
Well, it's an interesting game.
Yeah, it's a super interesting game, but it's actually funny that he brings up Urban Champion, because I recently picked this up. It was a Club Nintendo reward game for, you know, 100 coins. It was the 3D.
You picked it up too?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was the 3D Classics version on 3DS.
That's quite a coincidence because I actually picked it up off the eShop. I mean, I paid the full $5 for it. I mean, I felt...
Holy shit.
I did as well, John.
I mean, yeah, I kind of looked at it as a museum piece of sorts, you know? I mean, when you go to a museum, you know, you'll see a piece of work that perhaps is a little bit primitive maybe, but is incredibly important in the development of the art and genre as a whole. So that's how I kind of saw Urban Champion.
Urban Champion is not a performance piece.
It's certainly a progenitor of other types of fighting games.
It's not that primitive, though. You got to put yourself in context. Like, people up to then had seen, like, Atari 2600 games, and, like, then, like, you put that in front of them, like, a game with giant characters who actually have faces and expressions. And, you know, like, just to give you an example, like, when the cop car just, like, you know, goes in front of you and both guys just, like, get away from each other and whistle, like, it's almost like...
Oh, shit, here come the popo.
It's like watching a cartoon. It's fantastic.
Yeah, that's a really good scene. I've been playing this for the first time, and I'd heard a lot of, you know, shit talking about Urban Champion, and I'm not going to say it's my favorite game ever or anything, but, like, there's more to it than I thought. You know, it is a simple game, and it definitely feels like a kind of an early black box NES game. But there's more to it. You know, it took me a while of playing because the game has no, you know, maybe, I guess maybe there's an instruction manual if you hit the home button or something.
There is,
I don't
yeah.
know, but mm-hmm. I didn't look at that. I was just trying, I figured I don't need instructions to play this. And I kind of did, because I didn't realize at first you can block up and down. And so, you know, there's actually some strategy and some, you have to be really quick, but you can play it reactively as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you have a light punch and a heavy punch, and you try to figure out, like, it's a game about spacing, right? Because you're pushing, the two characters fighting are pushing each other towards either side. And so you're trying to control the territory a little bit. And so then you've got this weird stuff like the cop coming and the person up above dropping the flower pot. And so you have to be kind of aware of your environment as well as the other person.
Yes.
So you're kind of juggling a few different things.
I've got like a pretty funny story. Like at some point I was, you know, beating up the guy and, you know, I was close to winning, but then the flower pot, you know, like I could see the neighbor upstairs just getting ready with his flower pot.
Mm-hmm.
But I won at the last second, and instead of throwing a flower pot, it threw confettis. I felt like a million bucks. It was awesome.
I've had it happen a couple times now.
It's kind of that kind of surprise, you know, that makes the game pretty worthwhile. You know,
it's like fireworks at the end of a Super Mario Brothers level.
Yep.
Yeah. A bit, yeah. I mean, what's kind of interesting about this game from this standpoint is that it's got a bit in common. It's almost like side-scrolling Punch-Out, which would make sense if this came out.
That's what I thought of too.
If this came out before Punch-Out, but it actually didn't. The Punch-Out arcade game came out a full 2 years before this game came out.
Really?
Huh. Yeah. Now it came out before the NES Punch-Out, but it may be that they just couldn't do Punch-Out on the NES, and they made this instead.
Well, they thought they couldn't.
Well, at the time they couldn't.
Right. When Punch-Out did come out on NES, it was actually kind of a really advanced NES, you know, Famicom and NES game, because of the really large characters on the screen. And it didn't use any special chips, but it was using some really weird programming tricks to get the characters to be that large and the animations to be that clear, so that you could actually understand, you know, what was going to happen. So that was a big deal. Now, I wonder if you guys have ever played an old NES game called Street Fighter 2010, I think it is.
Yes, I have.
I have played that.
Because this reminded me of that also. So that was, at the time, it was, you know, Street Fighter and Street Fighter 2. I think mainly the first Street Fighter was becoming somewhat popular in arcades. And Capcom looked at the NES and said, well, we sure wish we could put a version of it on here, but there's no way we can put any kind of faithful, good version of Street Fighter on NES.
So they made this shit instead.
So yeah, they made a weird like alternate future where I think it's Ken is in the year 2010, you know, the far flung future of 2010.
I think it was actually like a game where in Japan it was something else entirely, and when they localized it, they just went and we're gonna call this guy Ken.
That would make more sense than it being canonical.
No, it's Nimaru Ichimaru Street Fighter, so it'd be 2010 Street Fighter.
Yeah, I remember Street Fighter 2010 as a platformer.
It was a little more, it was a little more platformy than this, but it was also very beat 'em up, and I think it kind of had the pace of Urban Champion, except that your character, who was like future Time Cop version of Ken from Street Fighter, they didn't look anything like him, because I think he had a helmet on or something.
He has sunglasses and a metal suit, because he's a robot.
He's very he's very kind of Power Ranger-y.
But he could throw fireballs. He could do the Hadouken. So he would I think it was really hard to do on the NES controller, but if you could kind of do the Hadouken, then he would throw a fireball, and so that gave you a major advantage over the enemies. But a lot of it was just kind of this, you know, poking and punching thing that was very much like Urban Champion.
Yeah.
Very similar scale, too.
Much more complex, but yeah.
How far did you guys get in Urban Champion?
It's funny, because I'm reasonably confident that I could write an algorithm to just beat this game. And never lose. Never, ever lose. Because I don't think I've actually done appreciably anything much different than what I've done since I figured out the hard punch and soft punch. And so I'm up to, like, 40, but it's only by merit of the fact that I'm just – don't care enough to keep pressing through.
Yeah. You kind of broke it.
Well,
right?
I actually, like, at the round stage 44, I started getting beaten up, and I just couldn't go further. It was a little bit, you know, a bruise on my ego.
Emasculating? Is that the word you're looking for?
A little bit, yeah. Because up to then, like, I was just beating up everyone. It was a pretty good feeling, but then I don't know, like, the AI does get better. It's surprising the amount of complexity that it can have.
I think I made it up to level 14, I think.
I mean, it is punch out mechanics. There's high block, low block, high punch, low punch.
Yep.
I mean, that's all, and there's dodge. So all of that stuff is in Punch-Out. I think based on the fact that the arcade game had been about 2 years and this came out, I think it'd be pretty – and there's a lot of the same people involved, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it would be relatively obvious that there is some level of cross-pollination of ideas here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first thing I thought of. I was like, wow, this is actually just like Punch-Out, and it's not as terrible as I thought it would have been. It's actually kind of fun. It's very repetitive.
It's very repetitive.
Yeah,
but it has kind of a story if you're paying attention. Like just the fact that you rise up from, you know, like your title keeps going from like street champion to alley champion to you know, eventually I assume it's urban champion, but I didn't make it that far.
Yeah.
Does the game have an end?
I would assume it would end at like level 99, but. Because that's how a lot of
it has a kill
games...
screen, James.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm wondering about.
You kill yourself.
It may just have a kill screen. I wouldn't be surprised at all. It just stops. Game just stops.
You know, it's been remade in especially the 3D version. I'm sure they've cleaned up some of those little buggy things. Like if there was a kill screen, but I thought the you know, on the 3DS version, I just turned the 3D effect and the perspective all the way to the max.
Oh yeah,
and it actually looks really cool. They've done this kind of almost like voxel thing where you see the 2D sprites, but then they've given them a certain amount of depth, so that it makes them look like very blocky, three-dimensional polygonal characters.
Yeah, kind of a 3D dot Game Hero thing going on. Yeah,
only actually 3D.
Well, like, it also has the 3D visual effect. Yeah, so
that's what I mean. It's got like real visually 3D effect going
on. Which that part is neat, but like you can imagine that if they didn't give it this weird camera angle and the kind of depth of the characters, then the 3D effect wouldn't really do much for this game. So I thought it was very smart, you know, whereas some other things like, you know, like Kirby's Adventure, they didn't go to nearly that level of effort when they made the 3D version. They just kind of made the backgrounds separate out. But I think the problem is Urban Champion didn't really have backgrounds. You have the building, but then behind that is just, it's just blackness.
The flower shop.
Yeah, that town has a lot of the same store over and over again.
Yeah.
It's like Flintstones level backgrounds. I mean, yeah, it's the discount shop. Yeah. What does it sell? It sells discounts.
There's also a thrift store, I think.
it sells coupons for other stores.
This is what Japan. This is how Japan thought America looked in 1980s. It's like this is it.
That's pretty awesome.
It's Groupon. It's the prototypical Groupon. They sell discounts for other stores.
Everything has a progenitor, my friends.
So do we think that this game is ripe for like a revival, like perhaps a sequel, or
no?
I mean, there's obviously other progenitors here, but this is sort of an archetype for the straightforward 2D brawler. You know, you've got
Double Dragon, Final Fight, etc. Yeah. Streets of Rage,
the finalist of fights. I mean, it's very functionally similar to a lot of those games.
Well, and you make a good point, James, because like if you think about like an actual fighting game like Street Fighter. You know, you're on this stage and it has edges that you can never go past. And so there's this arena that you're constrained to. Whereas in Urban Champion, you can knock a guy back to the next screen over. And so if you continue to do well, you really are kind of progressing off to the right, much like a Double Dragon. You know, you're kind of, it feels like there's a world. It's a very simple, repetitive world, but it does feel like you're kind of marching through it. And
he's just walking around the block and punching people.
Yeah.
Right.
In a manhole.
Actually, that's a good explanation. He's going in circles, and that's why you see the same stores over and over. That's really good.
I don't see how you could become the champion of an entire city by going around in circles.
Because he gets street cred on his block punching.
Yeah,
because the fools come to him.
And I mean, really, like you would have to think that after a while, the sewers would actually fill up with people.
It's fine.
With these people with concussions, you know.
They become the mole people.
These bloodied individuals.
Detroit. It's not like they were going to be able to go to a hospital anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
I wish there were multiple like vertical levels so that when you got knocked out and rolled into the sewer, you would then play in the sewer against all the guys you defeated before and try to become the sewer champion.
Against the kingdom that is now ruled by the last guy you dropped in there. And every guy you drop in being stronger than the previous, the line of succession continues.
It's kind of like winning the loser's bracket in a softball tournament.
Yeah, well, precisely. What amuses me more than anything, though, is how basically you're punching the same dude for like a really long ass time. And then eventually he falls into the sewer and you're like, all right, clearly there's not going to be another green haired. Oh, son of a bitch.
Oh, here we go.
It's like, how many twins do you have, bro?
I know.
No, they're not twins. That's their gang. That's their thing. They dye their hair green.
The green haired, green t-shirt, orange pants gang.
So you can see them from far off and keep out of their way.
Or punch them in the face.
Yeah, they're well known. Colors.
In the face.
Their hands don't have enough definition to do gang signs, so that, you know, you have to work within the limitations of the system.
It's kind of a funny quirk of the Nintendo colored ship. The colors, I mean, the game actually looks really colorful because, in part, because of the limitations of the graphics chip to show multicolors.
Mm-hmm. Very bold.
Yeah, I do like when you get knocked into the sewer, though, that they shower the guy with the confetti as well. Oh, because apparently that bitch up there is all about the new guy.
Yeah, I mean,
she's not about you.
Well, she just, you know, she'll obviously, you know, pass out her flower pot to anybody who, you know, the highest bidder, if you will.
Oh, shower them with confetti.
Mm-hmm.
What a floozy!
It's all metaphor.
It's all metaphor.
Urban champion is a metaphorical journey through life.
John, you live in Atlanta now, right? Mm-hmm. So this is pretty much what you have to do going to work every day?
I see this every day.
Is it like you're just trying to go to the snack bar and the discount shop, and there's like this dude you have to punch in the face?
Absolutely.
Until it falls in the
sewer? I look for the nearest manhole. I know where all the manholes are between here and Alpharetta.
What happens if the manhole's closed? Does the fight go forever?
It just rolls onto the next screen. It never really ends. The fight never really ends.
Oh, that's deep.
What if you reach the mm-hmm. discount store? Do you keep fighting him? You just be like, no, I'm here. All right, I'll see you later, bro. Just keep going?
That's how it rolls.
Oh, my God.
You know?
It's
you're either a champion or a chump, James.
A chumpian.
Yeah. And the name of the game is not Urban Chump.
All right. You've been listening to the Giant Bombcast, and it's time to move on to the next email. The next email is from Inner, and he writes, the most interesting number that stood out to me from the recent Nintendo financial report was the number of new titles for 3DS. While Japan maintained a new title count in the 90s, the Americas went from high 80s down to 77. The recent 3DS announcements, especially Bravely Default, Nintendo's mission to localize more Japanese titles to the world, and Iwata becoming CEO of NOA indicate a strong push of 3DS in non-Japan markets. This is a good move, right? While the Wii U could use a strong push as well, that seems to require far more time. Nintendo's recent focus to provide web-based and Unity Engine support for Wii U is an interesting move that I don't see from its competitors. Seeing as how the Wii U will not get Unreal Engine 4 support, Nintendo is using tools that are very familiar to mobile app developers. Is this a strategy to court mobile game developers to also be console developers? Is this a wise strategy for Nintendo to pursue?
Well, I just to quickly correct there, the 360 and PS3 both support Unity development.
Mm.
Pretty much everything does it not?
Yeah, that's
kind of the point of Unity.
Yeah,
that's why it's called Unity.
But
to be fair, in effect, I think there are very few Unity games on those systems.
Oh, yeah,
because
that's the more noteworthy thing. The web Nintendo web framework and the support that they've put behind it. That they made they went to the scene of one of their most insular, boneheaded, and ridiculous statements about these sort of these indie development studios,
which is that Netflix is coming soon to your 3DS.
No. The Iwata's commentary about indie developers and all and they basically did a complete 180.
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, the most telling moment wasn't something that happened in a press conference or anything. I want to say it was Intel was showing off a product that converts iOS apps to HTML5.
Yeah.
And Nintendo went out of their way to go demo, to go convert a simple app, to partner with them to convert a simple app, and then just see if it worked on their platform.
Mm-hmm.
Just as an ad hoc demo. And that's a kind of sort of spirit that Nintendo doesn't normally have.
That's pretty ballsy, because like,
What if it didn't work?
If you show up with your app and they try to convert it and it doesn't work, you're going to be like, what are you jokers even doing here?
Well, and they didn't I mean, as far as we know, they didn't even know about the Intel product beforehand. Intel basically tweeted at them like, I think this might work if we tried it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They're like, And they're like, okay, let's try it.
Oh, that's awesome.
They just went over there and did it. And it worked. And it was, I mean, they had to do a little bit of tweaking to it, but they got the game running in like a really simple game running in a few minutes. I mean, that's not something Nintendo would normally do.
Yeah.
But I just want to...
They certainly wouldn't do it with the eyes of developers and the press watching them as they did it.
Right, at GDC. But James, I want to go back real quickly to your comment that actually 360 and PS3 do support these engines.
Well, they
like
support Unity. They support HTML5.
But I would say the reason that you don't see many Unity games on those platforms is that if you can afford to put a game on those platforms, you can probably afford to use something better than Unity.
You can use the dev kits, yeah.
Right. So
I mean, especially XNA. XNA is really easy to get a hold of.
Sure, but then you're stuck using the Xbox Indie Games channel, which is kind of a graveyard of talented development and cool ideas.
And untalented development.
And a lot of other things, too. But the interesting thing here is that what Nintendo is saying with Wii U is that not only does our system support Unity, but our publishing platform, our distribution licensing network is so liberal that you can make a game with Unity and you can actually afford to release it on this system. And that's the reason that, you know, and they're getting better, but even from the beginning, even before the system launched, they were reaching out to people and they were trying to sell this as being a very indie friendly system. And I think, you know, with PS4 recently announced, Sony has been going after indies pretty hard and they're doing a good job with it on Vita and PS3 as well in a way that they haven't necessarily for the past few years. They're no longer necessarily grooming or publishing games. They're just kind of, you know, they're marketing their platform as saying, guys, you should put your games here and they will sell and we will support you and we'll make it easy for you. But Nintendo deserves a lot of that same credit for Wii U. It's just it hasn't proven as fruitful yet because the system is newer.
Well, yeah, and a lot of the, you know, like their past is haunting them. Like what I've read is that at GDC, like they did have like a panel or something for the developers, like how to get your game on the eShop, and basically the room was almost empty, you know, like there was a clumsy people taking notes, but.
What's weird is I think it almost would have been better for them to have announced all this stuff ahead of time because the buzz from that community picked up after the show.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the opportunity to engage with them directly was lost because they weren't engaged beforehand. Mm-hmm. It's kind of makes an interesting case for what they're going to do with E3 this year. Mm. But that's a side conversation
we'll have
later.
The thing. Like, it's an ongoing effort because after that you saw Dan Edelman. He's the downloads guy for Nintendo. And like he wrote on Gamasutra. He went to this event in Vancouver to court indie Canadian developers. Basically he's going around and just trying to gather as much support as he can. So
right, they hosted an event, I believe, just targeted at developers to try to get them on board. And I want to say it was a combination of evangelizing and tutorials, essentially.
Yeah, I hate to say this, but maybe they should do that at E3 also, because the thing that concerns me right now is that, you know, while Nintendo is apparently spending some effort, you know, I'm sure it's a small kind of grassroots thing within NOA, but they're spending some effort to get these people on board. And you've got stuff like Cloudberry Kingdom and Shovel Knight and Tokitori 2, you know, from very, very small developers are coming out on Wii U and are maybe doing well. I don't know. But at least they're coming out, and it is possible for a very small studio to release a game on there, even more so than on WiiWare, you know, and hopefully in a more favorable environment. But I'm not sure Nintendo is giving this same level of effort to the big companies, like the kind of companies that go to E3. I mean, you know, there was a report on IGN a couple days ago that Avalanche Studios, who are the makers of Just Cause, I don't know that they've ever made a game for a Nintendo system. That's neither here nor there. But they quoted them as saying their Wii U development kits have been sort of collecting dust and that they have no intention of making Wii U games because the market is so small. And also they feel like they don't really know who they would even talk to at Nintendo. Now, I call bullshit on this. If you've got multiple development kits already, you clearly have a connection at the company. Mm. And, And based on, you know, teams of three people who do a Kickstarter, if they can get in touch with Nintendo and you know, secure the assurance that their system will indeed run on Wii U and will be able to be published on that, then surely a, you know, a corporate studio like that can pull it off. I think that's just a kind of a case of, we just kind of don't give a shit. That's what it tells me. It's like, you can make all these excuses. Why don't you just say that you don't care? Because that's the honest answer, right?
Well, exactly.
So to me, where I'm curious if how Nintendo comes out big guns at something like PAX Dev, which I think is in June. Like if they come out really, really, really loud there, and they're somewhat mum at E3 about, you know, talking, like, we don't hear much about them talking backroom stuff at E3, but we hear a lot about what they do at PAX Dev. I think that sort of signals to us that they're basically going to try to rely on it. On a subset of the major publishers that they know will support them and their own stuff and get through with indie material, because they have a lot of ground to make up with companies that they should have a good relationship with. And if we don't see that action, then we can sort of infer that their strategy is, you know, if they come, they come. If they don't,
well, and that's not a good strategy.
which is not a strategy they haven't adopted in the past.
You know, it's already going badly for them. You know, you've got tons of multi-platform games not only coming out but even being announced specifically without a Wii U version, which is very disturbing, because these are games that are coming to PS3 and 360. Like, there's very little reason not to release them on Wii U, except that they just can't be bothered, I guess, or they don't think it's a good value proposition. And that's Nintendo's, that's up to Nintendo to fix that problem. You know, we just heard last week that Madden's not coming out on Wii U this year. And I think that's astounding. I think it's just totally bizarre. And maybe it has as much to do with EA's corporate troubles and their, you know, dicey situation based on various failures recently. But I think it also, like, when they've already got an engine, I mean, Madden came out last year on Wii U, so they have a version of it that works. It's not, you know, I mean, you know, if you set your expectations really, really low, it's hard to imagine it costing them that much money to release a new version of it for this year. If they just want to do real shitty job, it's going to get bad reviews, but surely they could sell enough copies to make their money back on releasing a barely updated version of the game that they already have on the platform. What the fuck's going on with that?
All I can think about that is that they laid off that team. Maybe they just don't want to go down the road of having to support that game and it's online play.
That's scary.
That's the kind of thing, right? It's not just a game. Madden nowadays is not just a game that you can just fire and forget. You have to sit there and support it. You have to sit there and maintain the servers, all that kind of stuff. And that stuff does cost money over time.
Yeah, and the fact is, like, Nintendo still doesn't have quite all its shit together for the eShop. I mean, you can't... There's no game right now that you can buy something from the game, or that you can choose, like, buy DLC, and it will go to the DLC. Like, it will open the shop for you. You have to exit the game, you have to go to the eShop, you have to buy the thing. Like, it's all a separate process that... you don't have to go through on PSN, and I assume you don't have to go through on XBLA.
You don't have to go through that on Wii. There are Wii games you can buy DLC from in the menus.
Well, but for that matter, I don't even think you can buy last year's Madden on the eShop. Which, and there's several games like that from big studios like EA and Activision, and that tells me Nintendo has done a very poor job of selling this new digital, much improved digital platform to these big publishers, because you've got small companies who seem to be doing really well on it, you know, and they're getting buzz, and they're, you know, lots of people playing their games and talking about their games. And yet, you know, I can't buy Call of Duty on the eShop.
But you
Why?
Know, but you know,
Why
you
not?
Say that,
it's stupid.
But
yeah.
We had Tank, which was a retail game, get a freemium version less than 6 months later.
Yeah.
And so to me, Nintendo is doing something. I think it's more an issue of our people
listening.
Well,
no, I'm saying I think the tools are there. I think the eShop is very flexible, and clearly you can put a lot of different kinds of games and different kinds of pay models on it. Mm. The problem is publishers don't seem to understand it. They don't seem to know, they don't seem to get the value in using it. And that's Nintendo's fault.
Yeah, but I actually, you know, I downloaded Tank. I tried playing it, and then I tried buying the Kong mode. But when you choose that option, it tells you go to the eShop.
Yeah, it does.
And then, like, you press the home button, And you're still in the game. You press the home button. You go to the eShop. You can go buy it. But then you have to restart the game anyway. Yeah, sure. It makes no sense. Yeah. Like the eShop is not quite all, you know, coming together yet.
I get that. But my point was that a company released a game, realized it wasn't going to do them much of anything, and made a radical transformation in the game's pay structure and basically deployed it to the eShop in a way that you probably can't do on any other system right now. And to an extent, yes, Nintendo needs to do a better job educating, but there's only so much they can do. If companies aren't listening, and I mean,
if companies don't want to deal with them, there's nothing
we don't
Nintendo
have a contact
do.
At their company. That's bullshit. You have multiple dev kits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sorry. There's only so much they can do to push that message to other companies.
Yeah. I mean, this is often the thing you run into is, you know, you hear from companies. I feel like Nintendo gets as much bad press as they do good press. I mean, you'll have some companies, you never really know exactly what the real story is because, you know, some will say, wow, they're great to deal with. And then some will say, ah, they're terrible to deal with. So you never really know. You know, it's hard to get a finger on exactly what the deal is with Nintendo and all these devs.
There's two people at Nintendo working with third parties. One is an asshole, and the other is just awesome.
I guess so.
Their names are Good Cop and Bad Cop.
I guess so.
You know, the other big news that we got, and this is also out of EA, very troubling, I think, is that not only did EA get the exclusive Star Wars license, you know, now that LucasArts has been pretty much shut down, they're now going to be making Star Wars games exclusively for who knows how many years. And I think this kind of exclusive deal with such a big license is a horrible thing. It's been terrible for the NFL, you know, and for those games. And it's been bad for MLB and NBA, and it's going to be bad for Star Wars, I think. But also one of the producers at EA went on Twitter and said that he was kind of bragging that all their new Star Wars games are going to run on Frostbite 3 engine, which is a really powerful, you know, very advanced engine that they have not gotten working on Wii U, which means that all these new Star Wars games that are come out to support Episode 7 and all the other crazy stuff they're going to do, they're probably not going to come out on Wii U, or it'll be some really gimped version just like we had back on the Wii. There's no way
if the Wii U becomes an even remotely successful console, there's no way Disney allows them to not publish Wii U versions of big movie tie-ins.
Yeah, but I mean they also said that they were trying to get Frostbite 2 going on it, and they couldn't get that to go, so they just abandoned Frostbite 3 altogether.
So they never even bothered trying 3.
So
there's no reason Frostbite 2 won't run on the Wii U. There isn't.
I don't see that. And that's the whole thing. I mean, I think they're
That's a we don't care.
Yeah, sure, somebody can get it running. It's not going to be us. Epic said the same thing about Unreal Engine as well. I mean, they're like, sure, somebody could do it. It's not going
to
be us.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a significant amount of work involved to get one of those engines working on Wii U, which does have a different architecture than the other systems. I mean, it's in some ways similar to 360, but in a lot of ways very different.
Yeah, but I mean, it's more similar to 360 than the PS3 was to sell. I mean, the PS3 was to anything else. PS3's fucking crazy
down.
Right,
that's the thing. Well, look, the reason is PS3 ended up selling a lot of systems. Wii U has not. So eventually people hunkered down and figured out how to do it on PS3 because it was worthwhile. So again, this kind of comes back to Nintendo. They've got to sell enough systems to change people's minds, and that includes developers.
Yep.
It's a big problem. So we'll see if they can fix it.
Yeah, I mean, the Wii U has an uphill climb just because not only is it not selling, but also there's also that built-in perceived, you know, audience thing where it's like, "Oh, we have this type of game, that's not going to sell on a Nintendo console." So that's why a lot of these devs they make certain types of games that are perceived not to sell on Nintendo consoles, and they believe that themselves. So it's tough. It's a tough spot to be in.
It absolutely is. I don't know if we're going to get any kind of resolution on this from E3. I kind of feel like we're not. I mean, does anyone really expect a huge third-party announcement during that Nintendo Direct that's going to come up at E3 where they show the new Mario and the new Metroid or whatever?
No.
I expect one. I expect Nintendo to have strategically held one in the chamber they can say they had one.
I agree with James. I mean, I think there'll be maybe a handful of them, but there'll be like one game, like, you know, like Grand Theft Auto for DS.
Who's it going to be? Ubisoft?
It doesn't really matter who it is. I think just that there is one. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a big, you know, I'd say a big five publisher.
I was going to say maybe a big Japanese company because they.
But no, I think there probably will be Japanese games there. They don't have to do. I think because remember Nintendo's focus at E3 this year is Western developers.
Yeah,
is Western market. I mean, they're
Western market Japanese developers. Like, could be Capcom.
Yeah, it could be. But I mean, Capcom right now. Oh, if you, anything you announce there is about 30% chance of getting canceled anyway.
All right. Well, we need to move on to the next email, and Guillaume is going to read that one.
JR writes, I'd like to know all of your thoughts on the upcoming Eternal Darkness follow-up, but more specifically, what do you think this will mean for the Wii U? I'm no sensationalist, and a niche game, like this, probably won't make much of a splash. That said...
Niche key game?
That said, this looks like the game that will convince me to get a Wii U, despite the fact that I already have a gaming PC to play it on, simply because the insanity effects on the controller are certain to really get me. There are so many creative ways to use the technology in a Wii U, and this is finally a game that could demonstrate it. Bonus question. What cool insanity effects do you think will be possible with a Wii U that it can do on other platforms?
Mm. Dennis Dyack producing and managing a project well.
That's the ultimate insanity effect. Come on.
It's going to be hard for me to divorce my feelings about this game from my feelings about the work of Dyack late in the Silicon Knights era.
But what's that based on, though? I feel...
They have a trilogy of games that they announced a decade ago that only one has come out in.
Hey, James. James, yes. What's the last Dennis Dyack game you played?
It would be that one.
Eternal Darkness?
Human.
Too Human, yeah.
Okay.
I feel like a lot of the way he is perceived has been tainted by somebody actually having the balls to sue Epic because people fucking love Epic and anybody that goes against Epic is hated.
But also he went and got, you know, NeoGAF in a fit I guess they're vocal and a lot of the bad blood I think comes from there. Although the people at NeoGAF who comment on this podcast are awesome.
Yes.
Dennis went on EGM Live about 6 or 7 years ago, mm-hmm. and he took a swipe at NeoGAF. And, you know, some of the things he – that's a fascinating podcast if you've never heard it. It's one for the ages. And some of the things he said I think are absolutely true. They are mired in his, you know, very typical over-complex philosophizing and, you know, obscure literary references and other stuff that makes people stop listening to him. But some of his criticisms about the way people behave on the internet and especially on gaming forums like that ring true to this day. But he did it in a pretty condescending way. And then he went and showed up over there and, you know, kicked the hornet's nest even more by posting a lot of very provocative stuff. And I understand ultimately why people don't like Dennis. I will say, full disclosure, he is a friend of mine. Now, I haven't talked to him in a long time. I saw him a couple years ago at E3 and we chatted for like 2 minutes. Okay. But back in the day, I've had a beer with Dennis Dyack. I've had food with Dennis Dyack. I've interviewed him like 5 times. I've known him longer than I've known any of you guys here on this show. I've known him since before I worked for Planet GameCube or Planet N2000. So I have an affinity for him. I have an affection for him. And I think he's a very, very smart and creative guy. I do not know to what extent he is responsible for what happened with Silicon Knights. I think I'm sure he is somewhat responsible. I don't think he's entirely responsible any more than I think he is entirely responsible for Eternal Darkness being a great game or Legacy of Kain Blood Omen being a great game or, you know, Twin Snakes being a pretty good game. I think it's a team and he had, you know, people above him and below him, and he had attorneys, and he had people telling him at some point this might be a good idea. I don't think he's that much of a loose cannon that his reputation builds up to, and I just want to put that out there.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the stuff that's said about him is said because of the stuff outside of the games that he has made.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Too Human is not a great game. It's a huge disappointment for me. I mean, Too Human was first shown at E3 1998, okay? And that game didn't come out until, I think, 2008. So that, that game right, was yeah. made at least twice. Okay,
I think officially it had three versions.
Well, it was a some kind of demo on GameCube as well. So it existed on at least three different platforms because originally it was a PS1 game. That game went through absolute development hell, and it's kind of a miracle it came out at all. Okay. And it was a huge disappointment for me. I think it lived up to zero of the promises that had been made originally and the things that I was excited about it. That's just not the game that came out. It's not a terrible game, but it's not what we were promised. And it's ultimately, you know, not a yeah. very good game. It's not great.
Dyack has kind of the Molyneux syndrome where he overpromises and then sure. you get the final game and it's just like, what the hell? Where are the infinite quantity of spells that you promised me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The things that Dennis was promising about Too Human are basically what Deus Ex Human Revolution turned into.
I mean, to me, the problem... Well, I mean, first off, the fact that that game's on a Wii U tells me more than anything else that he was really trying to make one last push to get Nintendo to publish this game. Mm-hmm. That they're like, look, it's running on your system. Mm-hmm. You should publish it. Look, right there. Come on.
Let me just say this about Dennis. I think it's very telling that his new company, Precursor Games, where he is not running that company. He's the creative director. There's a CEO and a COO above him, which I think is good because I think, you know, clearly he had some involvement with the business decisions over Silicon Knights and, you know, and share some of the blame for what happened over there. He is a very creative guy, and I think if they can keep him in a creative role, this whole thing might work. But I think it's very telling that almost all the employees they have currently at the new company, Precursor Games, came from Silicon Knights, which means, and mostly veterans, which means these are people who've worked with Dennis for years through the worst days of that company. Okay. These are people who worked on X-Men Destiny, who have been trying to get this Eternal Darkness sequel approved by Nintendo for years and couldn't get it made for whatever reason. Nintendo wasn't interested or it wasn't seen as being profitable or whatever.
Or they just saw the writing on the wall and said,
Sure. I don't know. But, you know, clearly Silicon Knights was a poisonous atmosphere. It was a poorly run company. They got mired in this very futile, actually kind of worse than futile lawsuit with Epic yeah. Games.
Yeah.
And the whole Too Human thing with Microsoft, which, you know, clearly Microsoft did that game very few favors. And, you know, and that was a very bad situation. They did a game, they were trying to do a game with Sega that never came out, and that went really bad. So they went through just the worst shit you could imagine at a game developer, and these people still came along with Dennis to form this new company and work on this project that they believe in. Mm-hmm. So they don't think he's evil or an idiot or a clown.
Yeah.
And they know him way better than any of us or any of the people over at GAF or our own forums who are making fun of this whole thing. I think there's a lot to be said for that. If he was going out and collecting up all the brand new college graduates from, you know, the University of Toronto game development program and saying, come on, let's work on a AAA game, I'd say, yeah, he's probably tricking them. Like, he's probably trying to take your money.
I like the idea of him going, come on, let's go, guys. Get in the van.
Maybe the people working at Precursor Games are all Canadian, and so they're just too damn nice. Let them go.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think there are other studios in that area.
Bribing them with poutine, obviously.
So, you know, and if you look at the trailer, it's pretty clear this game was in development for a while within Silicon Knights, and this new company.
But this game was Eternal Darkness 2 as well.
At some point, it was Eternal Darkness 2, and they couldn't get it published. You know, and of course they're limited by the fact Nintendo owns the publishing rights to Eternal Darkness. So they were their own, they were the only choice. If they're going to keep that name, then Nintendo is the only choice. And Nintendo, I'm sure, repeatedly told them, no, we're not interested. No, we're not interested. And now they've changed the name and they don't have to go through Nintendo. And so they've solved that problem. But it's clear that this game was in development for a long time. And even if you read the anonymous whistleblower reports about what was going on at Silicon Knights, which I think have some logical inconsistencies. And I'm not sure I believe everything that's in there, especially considering, again, people who worked with Dennis are still working with him by choice at a different company. So the idea that he's this clueless monster who's bringing down everything around him and is like willfully destroying the company and these people's careers, it doesn't even make sense. Okay. But this game clearly has been in development for a while, and they have something to work with to start with that is, you know, X percent far along. That gives me a lot more hope that this might actually happen. They're not building this from scratch. We found out just in the last couple of days that the new company, Precursor, bought all of these assets from Silicon Knights, which I'm sure SK was happy to do because they're, you know, millions of dollars in the hole right now. Happy to make a little bit of money off selling away this stuff. And plus they get to see maybe it actually gets made one day.
So, and despite all this, like, watch as an Eternal Darkness fan watching the trailer, I couldn't help but be a little bit excited, you know?
Like, yeah, me too.
It looks pretty damn good.
I want to say one thing as sort of a counterpoint to Johnny's spirited defense here.
I'm trying to keep an open mind, and I'm trying to say,
I get that.
When a person won't even give away their name when they disparage someone, you should probably discount what they have to say.
To me, I need to see this game played by humans that don't work for the company.
Right, and it may not be ready to do that yet.
Right, and until I see that, I don't care if I see somebody playing it at E3. We saw Aliens Colonial Marine do that. Until a person that doesn't work for that company plays that game and says, oh, this doesn't do anything really weird, or it doesn't have any strange design decisions that just don't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that they also don't want to too human it, right? Where, you know, they showed that and it was murdered everywhere.
The problem is, if they had listened to some of the criticisms they got for Too Human, that game would have been better.
You're right. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of hubris, but they were also working for friggin' Microsoft, and they may have had their hands tied on certain aspects.
I get that, but I mean, some of the stuff from Too Human that got pointed out from E3 demos would have been relatively easy to fix. Yeah.
So James won't be backing this. Johnny, are you backing it or?
No, I will buy this game if it comes out of curiosity and hopefulness and optimism. But I'm really not a huge fan of paying for games before they're even finished being made. Any more than I'm a fan of pre-ordering games, you know, and I'm not going to try to dissuade people from supporting this, because obviously it needs people to support it or else it will never even come out. I think it'll do okay. But there are many questions about what's going on over there, and, you know, is Epic even going to allow this game to get finished, or are they going to try to make some legal challenge and say, nah, you got to finish paying us back before you can, you know, go off and sell assets to a shell company of the same people? I mean, I'm worried about that kind of thing for sure. Let's get to the fun part.
I think
part.
That perhaps I'm being lazy here, but it's very, like, I'm just basically rehashing old Insanity effects, but now I don't think that programmers can actually use the TV feature of the Wii Remote. But if they could, like if they could use the TV remote feature of the gamepad, you know, instead of just faking lowering the volume or turning off the TV, they could actually do it.
What if they faked it and brought up a layover that looks identical to the real one and then made it look like someone was pushing the buttons?
Yeah, that I think that is definitely feasible. And also, like, you've got, like, some fun features, like the camera on the Wii U gamepad. Perhaps, like, you know, like, trying to take the face, capture the face of the person without his knowing would be a little bit too, like, it's a little bit too advanced to do. But perhaps, like, just have a feature where you take a picture of yourself and then you have rats eating your eyes. Huh? Huh? May the rats eat your eyes?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to hold the thing out in front of you, though. Otherwise, it would just be like looking up your nose.
So I could see a few things here. What if you, when you went to the home screen, they diverted it and took you to a fake Miiverse where everyone is telling you like really fucked up things about the game that aren't true?
That's pretty awesome.
What if there was a – so you know like how in Luigi's Mansion where sometimes they put you in like the first-person view and you kind of move around and you look at things? Or the panorama view is similar to this. So a number of Wii U games do this thing where you kind of use the gamepad as like a scanner, like a window that you're kind of – you know, a viewfinder that you're looking through. Like, to me, there's an opportunity here to – it's almost like a Fatal Frame kind of idea. But what if you're scanning around for some kind of puzzle element and you happen to sweep the view over something really horrifying in the environment? And you do a double take and you go back to it and it's not there anymore. That's something that you could not have done in the original Eternal Darkness because it didn't have camera control. Mm-hmm. But it would totally work in this game.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, to me, you could fuck with the player to a certain extent. But, I mean, I don't know how creative you can really be beyond just, you know, doing weird shit on the screen. I mean, ultimately, that's all it comes down to. It's not like they're going to make the game vibrate uncontrollably until you put the tablet controller down. I mean, they could. They could make it say, all right, engage the vibration motor until maximum until the tablet controller is perfectly parallel on a flat surface. I mean, they could do it. It would be a dick move, but it's certainly something they could do.
Yeah. They can also do a lot of things just within the gameplay that, you know, aren't hardware specific. But that, that was the nature of the question.
Yeah.
Yes. I think ultimately just completely fucking with the Wii or with the TV using their remote sensor or something like that is somewhat limiting because all the insanity effects in Eternal Darkness, with the exception of two, and it's the save corrupt one and the one where it basically just makes the game unplayable for about a few seconds. Hmm. They're mostly just stuff that happened in the background. Mm-hmm. You run through them. The ones where you go through a door and you have to basically wallow in the filth that is Eternal Darkness, only to find that you're back outside a couple seconds later, or the ones where it does the whole save file corruption thing, those are only really funny one time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then they just become kind of annoyances.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think anything they design, they probably should want to be more minimalistic. I know that takes away some of the fun, but ultimately it also makes them less of an irritant, you know, 20, 30 hours into the game.
Right. And we talked about this when we did Retroactive on Eternal Darkness, but I think my favorite ones are actually the ones where you don't get a reset, you know, you don't get the white flash and, oh, that didn't really happen. I think it's more fun when, you know, the statues that turn their heads to follow you or the walls that are bleeding or just little weird stuff that's kind of inconsequential, but it's very disturbing.
Yeah.
It's very, it enhances the atmosphere without interrupting the gameplay.
Yeah, I mean, get rid of the meter. I mean,
it's not useful at all.
Like, I mean, it just destroys the whole point, right?
I think having the as the meter decreased, the insanity effects became increasingly intense. I think.
Well, yeah, but you can just have like increasingly intense effects throughout the game, like as you.
But what if you don't? What if you're trying to concentrate on a fight? And you don't want to be constantly plagued by the white flash.
Well, too
then,
bad.
Like you're playing the wrong game.
No, I think there. If you're trying to progress through the game, there may be points where you want to be able to focus on the game. If the game becomes a gimmick to show you insanity effects, that game already exists. It's Spirit Camera on 3DS.
Mm.
It needs to be a game first and an insanity effect vehicle second.
Sure.
And that means there needs to be mechanisms. I think having the meter there makes it so you can focus on gameplay if that's what you're trying to accomplish at this particular sit-down.
I think the reason the sanity, and I've actually talked to Dennis about this, but I think the main reason, of course I'm mining old memories here.
Can we la-di-da you yet now?
No, but I think the reason that the sanity meter is in the game and is so visible is that they wanted to give the player at least some sense of empowerment. And I think 10 years ago, that makes sense. But in modern game development, I think they can afford to be a lot more subtle with that.
Right. And ultimately, they can make the game scarier by leaving it out. Like,
right.
This whole idea of empowerment, like, you don't want that if you want to scare someone.
See, I disagree, though, because while the game has scary elements in it, it is, at its heart, an adventure game.
Yeah.
So the very act of playing the game needs to be empowering. Otherwise, the characters would just fall into a ball and die. It becomes unjustifiable for these characters to accomplish what they do if there's no mechanism to empower the player.
Well,
because these are not normal humans.
James, keep in mind, the mechanism is combat. That was the whole point of Eternal Darkness. It's like Resident Evil, except the weapons don't
suck.
But if you're
being constantly paralyzed by one insanity effect after another, the combat's meaningless.
But again, what if the insanity effects are just kind of they're just atmospheric, they're in the background. So it doesn't have to directly affect the character in the game. It affects you, the player. That's the whole point, is it breaks the fourth wall. So then the question is, the thing that's hindering you from playing the game is not that the game is literally fucking with you and making your character lose health or making your controls reversed or anything that blatant and crude, but rather the game is affecting you, the player, psychologically, and now you can't play the game as well because you're too disturbed and distracted by this stuff. And then the solution is for you, the player, to take command of yourself and say, no, I have to get through this. That's what people who love horror games want. That's why people play Slenderman.
See, I don't know that we're going to be able to execute that level of subtlety, though.
Well, other people have already done it.
You could do it. You could have something like, you know, like you look at somebody, you look away from them, you look back at them, and something's changed, but then it fixes itself. And you don't really know what you just saw. But you think you saw something, but there's nothing that indicates that you actually did see something change.
Yeah, so do you continue to investigate it, or you just decide to move on?
Exactly. And you can move on. You have a choice there, but you could do it in a subtle fashion, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, guys. Well, we didn't get through as many emails as I wanted because, as usual, we got pretty carried away with the ones we did read. But I had a lot of fun, and, of course, we still have plenty left. So if you didn't hear your email, keep listening. We'll probably get some more next week. And as always, we will always try to catch up with the best emails. So again, the address, as always, rfn at nintendoworldreport.com, or click on the email link in the show notes at the website. That's pretty much it. We're getting ready for E3 and shit's getting real crazy, obviously, but we're looking forward to talking with you more about Nintendo next week. And in the meantime, if you're looking for more stuff to listen to, I hope you will go check out. We've got brand new episodes of a couple shows that I'm on. So Box Office Poison, our movie podcast. We just talked about Iron Man 3 and a bunch of other stuff. Lots of fun going on. It was just getting into the summer season, so we're always got really big movies to talk about on that show. And my show that I host and produce and really enjoy doing is called Discover Music Project. And we just had a new episode of that with our friend from NWR, Andy Gergen. And he and I talked about the music of Sufjan Stevens, which is absolutely crazy. So I hope you'll check those out. They're over at crosstalk.com. And in the meantime, you'll find us over at Nintendo World Report and NeoGAF and a few other places, Twitter, Facebook, etc. Anyway, thank you very much for listening and especially for writing in and interacting with us as always. And we'll be back here next week.
Bye.
Later.
Bye. There's this other boss, the Pharaoh man. Pharaoh. How do you pronounce that? Shit.
Pharaoh.
Okay. Pharaoh man.
Donkey Kong!
Months after the release of Leiden's first 3D adventure, the staff takes another stab at evaluating this puzzle encrusted completely in plausible tale. What am I reading?
Sorry, okay? I'm trying to write this quickly. You know...
Yeah, sure. Okay. Evaluate. Where were it?
Just
up.
Put a comma after encrusted.
Okay. Evaluating this puzzle and
this puzzle encrusted, comma, completely
shit.
Implausible.
Okay,
tale.
Now I get it.
All that's missing is the comma.
It's weird.
Donkey Kong.
All right, guys. Well, why don't we get into? What do you think? Should we go ahead and take a break?
Sure.
55
yeah.
minutes.
Might
that's
as well.
Probably for the best. And we'll just get through as many of these as we can.
Mm-hmm. Is James back?
James, are you here to clap? No. All right, let's just bide time until he can come back and clap.
Okay.
So you like stuff?
I like stuff. I was trying to find the music. Like I want to put in the background as I'm describing, you know, that horror scene. From Acquia, just like the music that plays in the game, but I can't really find it.
Hmm.
It's annoying. Maybe I'm gonna have to record it myself. I don't know if I can. I guess I just need a stereo to stereo, like a, you know, 1/8 inch plug.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Indeed. That'd actually be pretty damn useful. Being able to record any music off your handheld. Pretty freaking sweet.
I think so. That, or maybe I'll just ask TYP to get me the music.
Yeah.
Ask for a favor. In exchange, I'm going to edit your podcast. No. Sure?
Oh God, this map is amazing. I don't know how true this is, but you guys have to look at this.
Oh, the football coach thing?
Yeah, how did what you know?
Because I saw it today on Twitter.
Yeah.
Those things get around.
This is so fucked up.
Oh my God, it's awesome.
Although, well, but these are public employees, so that kind of makes sense, because usually, you know, they're public employees are capped at, you know, a certain level, and it's very, very particular kinds of careers that might take you over that.
That's actually a gross mischaracterization. Sometimes it is the basketball coach.
Yeah.
It's fucking awesome.
I want this podcast segment to end now so I can watch that Gravity trailer. Really?
Yeah, actually, I'm just going to watch that while we wait for James.
While I'm talking?
Huh?
I'm outraged.
Here, you guys can watch it too.
What is a Gravity?
It's the new movie by Alfonso Cuarón. The last movie he made was Children of Men in 2006.
Pretty good movie. Yeah. Not bad.
Fucking awesome movie.
Harry Potter
This
3.
Movie is about spacewalking with George Clooney.
Wow, so he's pretty big into sci-fi now, I guess.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Oh, that looks crazy.
Oh. Yeah, the rumor that I heard was that the entire movie is during a spacewalk. And that trailer syncs up, so. Oh. Baby.
Oh, baby.
I might have to watch that again a little bit later.
Come to Papa. All right, so
James Jones.
Well, maybe we don't need a clap at the end. I don't know.
That's up to you, man. Do you ever use it?
Rarely.
I kind of use it for a sanity check. That's about it.
A sanity check?
Yeah. Just to make sure I didn't go completely wrong somewhere.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you make mistakes. I don't. That was a joke.
No, it's also kind of true.
But yeah, well, no, I make mistakes. But I don't usually make the type of mistakes that I can't control Z right away out of.
I hear you.
All right, well, let's just stop.
Okay. We still have to wait for James so he can stop.
I know. Okay, well, I guess we can still record, but I'm going to the bathroom.
Sure.
Okay.
Do whatever you want to do, man. James, the musical fruit. I'm going to watch this trailer again.
Hey.
Have you seen James?
Oh. Have you seen Oblivion, the Tom Cruise movie?
No.
No. I've seen it described as Moon, but without all the things that made Moon work. So okay. I was planning on seeing it, and then I saw those reviews, and I was just like, I kind of have an idea of what it's about and perhaps how it ends, but also that it sucks.
I haven't really heard anybody say that it sucks. It just sounds really mediocre. It sounds like the kind of thing I'm happy to watch on DVD or Netflix after the fact, but you know, not something I'm gunning to go see in the theater.
Well, Karen and I had like free tickets for an IMAX 3D movie, and we're planning on using on that. But then we found out that they could work at another theater, and then we saw Jurassic Park 3D instead.
Nice.
Probably a good choice.
Yeah. Could have seen Iron Man too if you'd waited a little longer.
Don't mind paying for that.
Although Iron Man wasn't in IMAX.
What is going on? Did he Did his house just burn down? He hasn't signed yet, right?
Yeah, I wonder if this has to do with the house. I'm going to text him.
It might be. He did warn of panic attacks.
Surely that's not it.
I hope not.
Yo, did James return?
No, I just texted him.
One of the other games that I've been playing and given up on is the episodes from Liberty City.
I never even bothered playing. I got Lost in the Damned.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Really?
It's terrible. Yeah.
Why? What's so bad about it?
Have you ever ridden a motorcycle in Grand Theft Auto?
Oh, God. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I know one of the controls, reasons is terrible.
Yeah, the controls aren't better. Although, like, despite that, I still thought the races were the most fun part. But yeah, like, earlier you said, John, that the, why would you ever... Like, Death is not really a character you would want to be friends with. Like, why would you play as this asshole? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, in this game you play as a hairy biker. Yeah. And you wouldn't want to be friends with him either.
Yeah,
but, he manages to be even worse than the main character in GTA 4. Like, I don't care about these people, and, like, there's such... It's so full of bullshit, right? Like, the only reason why you're supposed to root for him is because, like, the chief of his gang just, like, you know, is coming back from a stint in prison, and he's hot-headed, right? And he wants to go immediately to war with the other biking gangs. And so, like, you're the rational one who wants just to, you know, to make money and keep the peace.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly you're the good guy, right? Except that immediately after that, like, you go with some other guy, steal some motorcycles, and then, like, some crooked cops saw you do it. And so, like, they want you to pay them for their silence.
Mm-hmm.
And so your answer to that is to lure them into an ambush and kill them. Like,
mm-hmm.
killing two cops. And not just two cops, actually, because they brought all their buddies. Like, I killed 20 cops. But the TV report after that just showed, like, oh, like, these two officers died. No, I killed 20.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, like, what was that all about? Like, trying to just make money and keep the peace? Like, you went after 20 cops, you stupid ass?
Yeah.
It's just...
Well, that's the whole thing, like, the whole, like...
But these games are famous for their wonderful storytelling, you
know? It's the godfather of video games, you know? It's the godfather of video games, man, you know?
But, like, who would want to be a hairy biker? Like, I just don't get it. Like, is that most guys, you know, wish fulfillment here? Like,
See, that's the whole thing. I mean, that's kind of... I feel like it's sort of ridden that whole train of, wow, I just want to be a badass and do anything. But it's, like, that was, like... That stuff got old, like... 6, 7, 8 years ago, you know, like, it was cool probably about through, you know, maybe the PS2 days. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, just for that game franchise, like, it's just kind of like, okay, I get it. You can get a tank and run over FBI cars. Okay. You know, after a while, you can only do that. You can only switch that around and do that so many different ways before it just kind of gets old.
Yeah. Yeah. So far I've just gone like 2 missions where I just gunned down cop after cop, or you know, rival gang member after one after the other, and it's just it's really not fun.
Yeah.
And like I didn't play GTA on the PS2, but I you know, I started out, like, my first open world game must have been like The Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so much better.
Yeah.
So much more fun.
Yeah. Well, it's almost
Hulk is pretty awesome.
Yeah. I actually never played Hulk, but I feel like
so. I want a Superman game made by those guys.
Yeah, it's so satisfying. That's the great thing. It's like...
Okay, sorry about that.
Oh, there you are.
Hey.
Let's clap.
Yeah.
Right, let's clap down.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Donkey Kong!